And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Two guests with me in the studio. Jerome Corsi received a Ph.D. from Harvard University in political science, and he has written many books and articles. He's an expert on political violence and terrorism. In 1981, he received a top secret clearance from the Agency for International Development, where he assisted in providing anti-terrorism hostage survival training to embassy personnel. In 2005, Dr. Corsi helped found and launch the Iran Freedom Foundation, a not-for-profit educational and charitable organization established to educate the public about the Islamic Republic of Iran and to promote freedom in the region. He's written a book called Atomic Iran. He was on my program in May. Jerome, welcome back to Coast.
George, great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Craig Smith is the chairman of the board of Swiss American Trading Corporation, one of the largest and most respected investment firms here in the United States. He is an author, commentator, and a very frequent radio and television guest. He is in the studio with us, too. Hi, Craig. How are
you? Hey, George. Good to be with you.
Both of you have touched on a subject that is very dear to my heart as well. Since I was a little boy, I have always been trying to figure out how all these dead dinosaurs and how all this decayed plant life could end up being fuel. And I got to tell you, as a kid, now this must have been, I was born in 1950, this must have been when I was about 14 or 15, 64, 65. I was petrified when I would read in my weekly reader, which was this little newsletter we got in the schools in Detroit, I was petrified where it said, we're going to run out of oil one day. It's all over, and we need an alternative fuel. And by that time, 1964, I said, my gosh, by the year 2000, that'll be it. It'll be gone. Yet it keeps coming and coming. It's like nobody has shut the spigot off. What's going on, Jerome?
Well, George, you're exactly right. You know, I grew up in Cleveland, and in 1946 I was born. Ever since I can remember, we've been running out of oil. And yet today there's more proven reserves of oil than ever in history, 1.2 trillion barrels. And just like you, George, I said it can't come from dinosaurs. I mean, there weren't enough of them. And how did it work? No one ever could prove how it came from dinosaurs.
And how did it get down so deep?
Right. I mean, I had a cat that died. We buried it. Dig it up a year later, there was no oil.
No oil. And it definitely wasn't down there 5,000, 6,000 feet or even further.
Exactly. And as a kid, I remember reading some of the old science things, and the Soviets were finding oil in the 50s, 5, 6,000 meters underneath the earth. And if they could find oil that far down, there weren't any dinosaurs that far down. It had to be from another origin. And that's why we wrote Black Gold Stranglehold around the science that was developed by the Soviets and Thomas Gold, who was really an astrophysicist. I mean, he was in Cornell and wrote a book that was just really revolutionary, arguing, as the Soviets did, that the Earth makes oil on a constant basis from deep within the Earth, and it exudes up through cracks in the Earth. And we're not going to run out. It's a constantly made natural biotic, not biotic, abiotic product. Abiotic has nothing to do with dying old dinosaurs or plants, decaying forests. It's made on a constant basis every day by the Earth.
And by tonight, I think we'll find out just why that is and why the oil industry continues to scare us about the possibility that one day we will run out of this kind of fuel, and what's really going on behind the door to get the prices up. It's just incredible the work that you, Jerome, and Craig did in this work. You know, Craig, I have talked to a lot of people who are beginning to get on this bandwagon. 5, 10 years ago, there weren't a lot of people who would accept this theory of abiotic oil. Now you can talk to a lot of people, and they're beginning to say, well, maybe this is possible. What's changing their minds?
You know, George, I think it's just the information that's now coming to the forefront. I mean, when Jerome and I were researching the book, it just seemed to be everybody that I was talking to about the research we were finding were saying, gosh, that makes sense to me. I knew that it didn't come from dinosaurs. It didn't make any sense. How could 1.2 trillion barrels, I mean, how many dinosaurs would it take to make 1.2 trillion barrels of oil? They would have eaten all the foliage off the earth. The earth would have been barren. It just didn't make any sense. And of course, Thomas Gold, being an astronomer, knew that the universe was full of hydrocarbons, Halley's Comet, the tail. We knew methane was existent there. There surely weren't any dinosaurs on Halley's Comet. So I think what's happening, George, is more people are starting to put good old-fashioned common sense to it. They're challenging the current logic and theory that's out there, and they're saying to themselves, it's got to be something different than what we've been told because we haven't run out.
And I think when M. King Hubbert put together his peak oil theory years ago, he had no idea that today they'd still be finding more and more oil reserves, right?
Well, that's right. You know, as we wrote about Hubbert and how he put together the peak theory, it was almost like he put it on the back of a napkin, and he drove the data into this curve. It looks like a mountain, you know, a peak curve. It raises up to a top point, and then it declines like a normal bell curve to nothing. And he forced the data into it so that when Hubbert had the peak and he said, we're going to run out of oil in the 70s, well, then we found tremendous amounts of oil around the world. So they just revised it.
Yeah.
Because it's almost, George, like inherent in the idea. If oil is fossil fuel, there are only so many dinosaurs, so we have to run out of oil.
Now, if that were the case, if we did get our oil from dead dinosaurs and plants, the theory holds up. Eventually, we're going to use all that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Sure. I mean, we've got to look at the numbers. In 1980, there were 645 billion barrels of proven reserve. Then by 85, it went to 670 billion. In 1990, a trillion. 1995, it went back down to 999 billion. Now it's over 1.28 trillion barrels.
And they keep finding more, Craig.
Well, it's like the Saudis. The Saudis have thought for years they only had 264 billion barrels of oil, but their own oil minister just revised that number upwards by 200 billion barrels. Rex Tillerson, the president of ExxonMobil, has been publicly seen making statements that there could be as many as 3 trillion to 7 trillion. I have it right here in a press release of barrels of oil out there. So why do we say we're running out?
Why are some regions of the planet more plentiful with oil than others? Case in point, we still have a political problem with Middle Eastern oil. It has changed the complexity of I think, this planet. Why, if the planet makes its own fuel, and I believe it does, why are some regions more loaded with oil than others?
It probably has to do with the fissures, the nature of the subterranean rock, even down to the mantle. I mean, conceivably, it was an area hit by meteorites that was fractured. Mm-hmm. But if oil is made deep within the earth and is seeping up, it's going to seek to come through fissures. And that's what the Soviets found, and likely, if we really studied that in the Middle East, we'd find that the region was uniquely suited to having oil seep up
so
into it.
They were in the right place at the right time.
Exactly, George. And this abiotic theory of oil being deep within the earth would suggest that anywhere we drilled, if we went deep enough into the mantle of the earth, we're going to find oil. And the pools of oil that we're discovering underneath Kazakhstan, one of the stans near Afghanistan below the Soviet Union, ex-Soviet Union, it's almost like that whole country is sitting on one huge pool of oil deep down within the earth, which has been discovered and explored within the last 5 years. Or Iran. Iran has gone, you know, like almost 25% increase in the amount of reserves that they say they have within 1 year by more exploration and looking deeper. Take a look at offshore in the United States, in
sure.
The Gulf. Offshore is the fastest growing area of oil exploration in the world. What we write in Black Gold Stranglehold is that there is enough oil in the continental United States and Alaska and offshore that if we realized it, we could be oil independent. we do not have to be importing 60% of our oil.
I get calls from people, farmers who own farmland that have oil wells that are owned by the big oil companies. They lease the property from these farmers. And these guys call me on the air and they say, George, they're all capped. They're not pumping anything out of it.
Exactly. And, you know, much of it has been capped until the price comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil companies are sitting on huge reserves that they're waiting for the price to come up on. But there is no reason in the world why we need to pay this much for gasoline. I mean, I think about all the truckers tonight listening to the program. We're going to be worried if they don't get their surcharges. They may not even have profitable trips that they're running through. And there's no reason for that. We haven't built a new refinery in the United States in the last 30 years. If we start getting into what we've argued in the book, oil is plentiful. We really are awash in crude oil, even right now in the United States. What we need is new refineries, and we need to change our thinking to realize that oil is plentiful, not fossil fuel. Doesn't have anything to do with dinosaurs, and we're not going to run out.
Just this week, British Petroleum announces a 34% increase in profits. Exxon will report tomorrow its biggest profit in its history. They're making money hand over fist.
And wait until people get their heating bills. That's when the next shoe is going to fall.
Right.
Wait until in the Northeast when the...
This year.
George, you know, natural gas prices have almost tripled in the last year and a half. Now, how is that going to affect people that are using natural gas to heat their homes, heat hot water, continue to cook on their stoves? It's got to change, and it can.
I want to talk with you both about natural gas as well as oil tonight as well, and just to get your thoughts on that and how it's created. And when we come back, we're going to go back a little bit. We're going to go back to a World War II. There's a reason for that, because that's where a lot of this started. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment with our guests, Jerry Corsi, Craig Smith. Their book is called Black Gold Stranglehold, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you haven't picked up your free CD yet called Perfect Possession on Exorcisms, hurry up, because eventually it will end. The CD is yours when you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter or renew. A couple ways to do that. Call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online. You'll see it right there on the coasttocoastam.com website, right there on the home page. By the way, up there on the coasttocoastam.com website, you'll get a look of our two guests, Jerry Corsi and Craig Smith, under the Digicam. So it is right there for you. You'll see an icon there. It says Digicam with a little camera there. It's all yours. Just click it, and there you are. You'll see them in the studio as they were moments ago. Now, in the third hour, we'll open up the phone lines. I've done a little flip-flop tonight because we have Jerry Corsi and Craig Smith here in the Los Angeles studios, and then I'll have open lines with you at the last hour of the program tonight. So I've just flipped things a little bit. Jerry and Craig, let's talk a little bit about more of the oil. Let's go back to when a lot of this started, when the world started using fuel, and it was probably right around World War II, wasn't it?
Certainly World War II was when we really, you're exactly right, George, we recognize the strategic significance of oil. We write in the book on Black Gold Stranglehold about two major studies. The U.S. did the strategic bombing study, and we showed that for all the bombing we did in Germany, as many airplanes were being made after we bombed the plants as before, because the Germans learned how to decentralized, and the machines were okay. They could keep the machines running even if the buildings
were
bombed.
They had them in little parcels, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They just spread them around. But what the Germans couldn't survive is when we bombed the oil, because without oil, they couldn't run the Panzer tanks.
Right.
They couldn't fly the airplanes. And Stalin recognized this. Stalin had two advantages against the Nazis. One was the Russian winter. The second was that we were bombing the oil fields of Polesti and the others, and he captured the Hungarian oil fields.
Mm-hmm.
So he commissioned a major study, Stalin did, at the end of World War II, because there was research coming out of the Russian scientists. They were finding oil 5,000-6,000 meters below the surface of the earth.
Meters.
This is down miles, 5,000-7,000 miles down below the surface of the earth, finding oil. And that was brought to Stalin's attention. And he commissioned his own Manhattan-style project to have the scientists go and study oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Stalin was no scientist, but he knew that if he could find oil that deep, and it was coming naturally from the earth, he wanted it.
Right.
And he wanted it for political reasons.
Sure, and control.
I guess. He didn't want to be in the position the Nazis were, where they would run out and didn't know they had their own oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, beginning in the 50s, with Stalin doing that, the Russians went from almost having no oil at all to where the Russians are today, which is the second major oil exporter in the world, right behind Saudi Arabia. And they found tremendous resources of oil deep down.
And isn't it interesting that since their collapse of the Soviet Union, their growth from World War II to that point was absolutely astounding, where they
exactly.
were able to keep pace with us, get into space before us, and I think a lot of that had to do with its knowledge of oil and that kind of exploration.
They had the ability to be self-sufficient in oil. Because when Stalin recognized that, he set the scientists to work, they found the oil, and they produced it. Now, we did not take advantage of that. Much of that scientific literature, there are thousands of articles written mm-hmm. in Russian. They weren't translated. Our scientists didn't think the Russians had anything that we could benefit from.
Right.
Stalin had no advantage in letting us know of this. And our scientists were all locked into the idea of fossil fuel, so their minds weren't open to have another concept.
So the Russians were really the first ones to start talking about oil as being abiotic?
Well, it goes back, if you look at the history of this, Mendeleev, who discovered and produced the atomic chart, the periodic chart that we all learn in chemistry, he was arguing against another Russian scientist, a guy named Lomonosov, and Lomonosov wrote in 1757, because they were finding biotic material in oil, he said it must have come from dinosaurs and ancient forests. And Mendeleev said nonsense. So there were hints in the scientific debate from scientists who said this couldn't possibly be synthesized from dying animals and plants, but they weren't listened to. I guess because when we think about pond slime and things, it looks
sure.
kind of like oil. And it wasn't very critically thought about, except when the scientists by Stalin were put on it, they proved that they could find oil very, very deep within the earth where there weren't possibly ever any dinosaurs.
I think another thing to look at, George, is the Russians were looking at oil from a strategic standpoint, a vulnerability for future
mm-hmm.
wars. We had just released the atomic bomb, and I think personally our scientists at that time were a little bit arrogant. We figured, hey, we have the bomb. We're impervious.
Sure.
They can attack wherever they want. All
right.
we have to do is drop a bomb, and we can kill a million people, and it will end. So the Russians were looking at it strictly from a strategic standpoint, and that's why they put the time and energy to develop technology that today is, if pace is kept, they will outproduce Saudi Arabia for oil production in calendar years 2006, 2007, and 2008. Now, isn't that amazing? Why aren't we hearing that in the news?
And had the Soviet Union stayed intact, all those splinter countries
exactly.
like Kazakhstan and everything else, all of those would be under the umbrella of the Soviet Union. Their reserves would be huge.
Unbelievable. Matter of fact, we talked about it on the break. I can't imagine a listener has ever heard Russia ever complaining that they're running out of oil, or that they don't have enough oil, or that they can't meet their energy needs.
Right.
Quite to the opposite. They are supplying oil to the world, and I think strategically that's something that we have to look at as a nation.
That's a good point. What about China? Are they producing oil over there?
Not very much. Again, China has not focused on their scientists looking deep enough for oil. And China has not been focused on yet the oil they're going to need for the expansion of their economy. They're right now on a track of getting it from Iran and other trading partners of that nature, anti-American trading partners.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They seem to be making deals that are sufficient there to get them the oil they need.
Right.
But China's going to, if you look at the growth rate in China is going to be probably two or three times the growth rate in the United States. So by the year 2025, you're going to have China dramatically increasing their need for oil, as is India. Now, we'll still be using more a day at that point
than anybody.
But they're going to be increasing by a rate where, let's say, 50 years from now or 70 years from now, their economies are going to become very competitive in size to ours, and their need for oil is going to grow to be comparable to ours.
Well, I guess if we're all wrong about abiotic oil, all of us, that's about the time period we're going to find out about it.
you bet. And you know, it's interesting what Jerry just pointed out. If you look at the demand that will come out of the United States in 2010, 15, 25, so on and so forth, it's about a 1.5% a year increase. On the other hand, China's demand is going to increase by 3.9% a year, and India 4.1%. Now, these are statistics that come right from our Department of Energy. So when they're forecasting the future, they're looking at huge increases of demand coming from areas that we don't really have that great a relationship with unless we're buying stuff for Walmart.
And when you're talking about the future, these oil companies are not stupid. These people are brilliant.
Absolutely.
They know how to manipulate your mind. They know how to trick you into thinking there's a shortage so they can increase the price. They know how to keep the price at a level, and then they drop it just at the boiler point. When they think Americans are just ready to bust at the seams, they'll drop it 30 cents a gallon or 40 cents. It's still higher than it was the year before.
That's right.
But then your feeling is you got a break, you got a deal. So they're very smart. And I sit back and I look and say, all right, if oil comes from fossil fuels and if peak oil is real, we're eventually going to run out. These very brilliant people will move into a different form of energy. They're
exactly.
going to get hydrogen going. They're going to be ready for us because they want to make money and they're not stupid. They're not doing that. It finally dawned on me that the reason why they're not doing it is because of this theory. They know they have an endless supply of oil.
Right. It's like the Atlantis project in the Gulf that they just spent $2.5 billion on, George, that's going to come online in the third quarter of 2006. That's going to produce about 150,000 barrels of oil a day. Now, who in their right mind, who's a CEO, would invest $2.5 billion unless they knew they were going to get back at least $2.5 billion
exactly.
and more in profit?
Yeah.
But it just doesn't make any sense.
It is brilliant marketing, though, isn't it, George? I mean, it's all from dinosaurs, the oil companies say, and we're going to run out because there are only so many dinosaurs. So they get to constantly hold a fire sale on oil, scaring people that we're never going to have enough. We have to conserve it. When the truth is, we have today 1.2 trillion barrels of proven oil reserves, more than ever in the history of man, and our increase of it has been dramatic over the last, almost doubled since 1970 worldwide, and proven reserves continue to expand dramatically. Those are the underlying statistics which do not jive with the idea that it's fossil fuel, it's hit a peak, we're going to decline down to nothing, and everything is going to go completely to the point where we have no energy left.
And we just heard the other day the Rand Corporation came out with a study that in the Great Basin, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, we have an additional, on top of the reserves Jerry talked about, 1.1 trillion barrels worth of reserves locked in the oil shales of Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. George, the more we look, the more we find we're not running out of oil.
And then when an oil platform sucks out the oil, it fills up years later, doesn't it?
That's right. There's a history, and it's very little documented to the public, but it's known by the oil geologists throughout the Middle East. We write about in Black Gold Stranglehold, a Eugene 330 in the Gulf. These are wells that have replenished. They are drilled, and they end up having reservoirs of oil below at very deep levels
right.
that then come up and fill in the oil that was drilled out. The oils do it comes up. If it's coming up from deep within the earth, abiotic, being produced on a continuous basis, the pressure is going to drive it to the surface. It's going to replenish what's taken out.
Might take a year or two, right?
Sure.
Or longer.
Well, it's like the Eugene Block 330 that Jerry's talking about. When they originally drilled the hole in 1972,
that's in the Gulf,
George,
right?
That's
in
correct. They were producing about 15,000 barrels a day. Then it dropped to 4,000, mm-hmm. which is the traditional Hubert's peak. You know, it peaked down, mm-hmm. now it's on the decline.
Seems like he's right.
Of course. Well, today it's back to pumping 13,400 barrels a day, and they're figuring that there are reserves of over 400 million barrels in that one hole.
Just that one spot.
I mean, it's just, you know.
Oh, my God.
But it is ridiculous because you've got, I mean, the book's coming out, you know, Twilight in the Desert. All Saudi Arabia is going to be pumped dry. Well, Saudi Arabia just announced that they think they've got double the reserves that they go and really explore further and fully report what's available.
Right.
It isn't, you know, 260 billion barrels. It may be more like 520 billion barrels. The estimates continuously increase. And what the peak oil theorists do is they say, oh, we were just wrong. Maybe it won't run out in 1970. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll run out in 2020.
Right.
And then as we get to, you know, 2006, we've still got more reserves
and we're
than
using
ever,
more.
And using more,
sure.
every day. Well, I said, well, we were just wrong. Maybe it'll be now 2050 that we run out. They don't stop to think that maybe we're awash in oil because the Earth is continuously producing it. And if we have the right theories and look for it deep enough as an abiotic product, forget about the dinosaurs, forget about the old decaying forests, go look at what the Earth, deep within the mantle of the Earth, produces on an everyday basis, combining two of the most common elements available in the Earth, hydrogen and carbon, in various forms. I mean, you know, if you want methane, go stick a pipe in a landfill. It doesn't take any dinosaurs in that landfill.
Or a cow pasture.
Exactly. And yet, the public has been told, school children are taught, we all say fossil fuel is synonymous with oil. And the truth is, the Soviet scientists around the world, scientists like Thomas Gold at Cornell, wrote a book in 1998.
He's still alive?
No, he passed away.
Oh, he
was in his 80s. He was a brilliant, very controversial scientist who had many breakthrough discoveries. He was one of the first people to work on radar with the British in World War II. He was mm-hmm. He was an astronomer who got attuned into radio technology applied to astronomy and radar. And where his intuition came is he was doing the spectrography analysis of planets, realizing the elements on these planets. And he realized that planets like Saturn had tremendous amounts of hydrocarbons on them. And there were no dinosaurs on Saturn as far as anyone could ever tell.
Well, you know, you said something about fear, and I think what they're trying to do is keep us in fear. Fear that we're running out of oil, fear that there's going to be a pandemic flu, fear of everything that happens. And I think their whole approach is, whoever they may be, is just to keep all of us with their thumb on top of us, just always constantly scared, afraid.
Well, and I think that's because most people don't want the incredible lifestyle that we live in America to ever change. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. We live a lifestyle that's second to none in the rest of the world. The average citizen of the world travels by ox cart. We travel by individual automobile.
Yeah.
And how did we get that, George? We got that by being able to get replenishable, steady supplies of inexpensive energy so that we could build buildings, heat buildings, air-conditioned buildings, use transportation. I mean, think about it. Jerry flew in from New York today. I drove up from San Diego. You couldn't do that without energy. And energy gives us this incredible life that we have here in America. So what would be easier to do? Threaten your lifestyle. People will change mm-hmm. and do whatever you ask them to
That's
do.
That's right. You know, if gasoline, and we're going to talk about that next hour, it's ridiculous price because it could go even higher. It's hovering at three now, higher in some spots. If it were back down to something manageable, $1 a gallon, $1.25, cars would be selling again. People would, the economy would be just booming like crazy. There's got to be a reason then why they want the price higher and for all of us to be stumbling along. Why do they want to do that to us?
You're very right to talk about fear, George. I think you're really on to something here. That fear is part of the overall, what we call black gold stranglehold. The stranglehold is for the average person to think that we're running out of oil and that it's reasonable to pay these outrageous prices. The truth is, there's plenty of oil. There's plenty of crude oil right now in the United States. The barriers are political. We have not built a new refinery in the United States in 30 years.
30?
30 years. Today, with the environmental restrictions, with all of the regulations, what you're going to have to do is spend hundreds of millions of dollars, take tens of years, and then no one wants the refinery in their backyard because it's smelly. Now, there are areas where we could put refineries out of the Gulf. I grew up in Cleveland. There were refineries in Cleveland. The Great Lakes are there. You can bring in oil through the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Sure.
And the industrial development of an area like Cleveland could be revitalized. That we need to break through the political barriers and the fear barriers, which go when we realize that oil is not fossil fuel and it's truly plentiful in the earth.
When we come back, let's talk also about global warming, which I happen to believe we're in a cycle. That's it, just an earth cycle. And then this incredible price of gasoline, which is around $3 a gallon. You think it might go how high? Just one number.
Oh,
Jerry?
$5 easily.
It's already $5 in England now.
Here in the United States?
No, in England.
No, but I think here in the United States, you think it'll go to $5?
It went to $5 in Atlanta during Hurricane Katrina.
That's true. We'll be back. And our special guest tonight, Jerry Corsi, Craig Smith. They are authors of the book, Black Gold, Stranglehold. This fascinating reading. The book is available on Amazon.com. And also it is published by Cumberland Publishing, part of World Net Daily, so you can get that. And I assume, gentlemen, it will shortly be in the bookstores?
November 7th is supposedly the day it will be in the bookstores.
Excellent. We'll be back with both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast. Of course, Jerry Corsi's website is AtomicIran.com. Jerry, before we're off the air later tonight, I want to talk with you later about the statements that the Iranian president made about Israel.
Absolutely.
We will do that. Let's talk about the price of oil, then we're going to talk about global warming as well. You know, the price is very high right now. They've dropped it a little bit, and again, I think just to keep us calm down, try to get it under that $3 level. It's starting to trickle down from there. But I think it'll level off in the 275, 280, and they'll keep it there for a long, long time until the next spike again, won't they?
Well, and also, George, the next shoe is about to fall because they're lowering the price of gas a little bit, and people are going to get their heating oil bills. Wait till the heating oil bills, even on natural gas, begin to hit. People are going to be shocked at paying, some paying twice as much for heating their homes in this coming winter.
Is there a shortage?
No, that's the thing, George, that we have more natural gas and oil now than ever.
Where's the natural gas come from, by the way? Well, how does the planet make that,
yes,
basically?
Yes, the planet makes natural gas, same as methane. It's the planet, often when we used to drill wells, we'd let the natural gas just go off.
Right.
We didn't have any use for it.
We didn't save it. That's
true.
We
didn't save it. So now what's happened is natural gas, including liquefied natural gas, is one of the fastest growing segments of the energy industry.
Okay.
And it's plentiful. We only import 20% of our natural gas. We have a great deal more natural gas here. It's the same as with nuclear power plants. If we had built the nuclear power plants that were on the drawing boards in the 80s, we could have a great deal more of our electricity around the country produced by nuclear power. We stopped, again blocked by the environmentalists, again blocked by fear, and not exploring with an understanding that energy is available. It's made by the earth on a constant basis, both oil and natural gas. It's an abiotic product. It has nothing to do with dinosaurs or decaying forests. And it's plentiful. We've got more reserves today of natural gas and oil oil 1.2 trillion barrels, despite the amount of oil we've been using in an increasing manner over the last 30 to 50 years. We're awash in oil, George.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about gas or methane, George. There was an experiment that we cite in the book that was done where scientists took two diamond anvils and they put them together and put them under tremendous pressure, about 110 gigapascals, which is 110,000 atmospheres of pressure. They put calcium carbonate, iron oxide, and water in this anvil, and they squeezed it together and then heated it to 500 degrees Celsius. Guess what happened? Instantly, methane was created.
Right.
No dinosaur debris, no rotting decay from. So clearly, if you can create methane in a lab from abiotic material, it's obviously being created as we're doing
this
program.
Well, and we've got a moon near Saturn called Titan that apparently is loaded with seas of methane. Did that moon once have dinosaurs and plant life? I don't think so.
I don't think Exxon thinks so either. I think Exxon understands, as do all the oil companies, that there's no need for them to develop hydrogen cars except in television commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's more oil than we could ever use. The bottleneck, as we describe in Black Gold Stranglehold, is that we have not built a new refinery in the last 30 years. So with all the crude oil that's available, even if the Saudis gave us twice as much, we couldn't refine it fast enough to get it into the gas pumps or into heating oil. That's the bottleneck right there.
Why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we building new refineries?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. Of course, we can thank the environmentalists for giving us cleaner air and cleaner water, but we can also thank them for keeping refineries from being built. We have a situation in Mobile, Arizona. It's just a little outside of Yuma, Arizona. There's nothing that can live there, George, but Gila monsters and rattlesnakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a fellow McGinnis that wants to build a refinery out there. He's been working on it for years, spent millions of dollars. He's not even in the permit stages because the environmentalists say he's going to wreck the desert. George, if you drove in this area, you would say, why in the world are we not putting this? Is nobody wants to live there.
Right.
This guy
There's
wants to build
there.
It there.
You can't even visit it, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's too hot in the middle of the summer. I mean, it's like Death Valley. And the bottom line is it's a perfect place for a refinery. Why aren't we doing it? And people are, you know, Hurricane Katrina showed a lot of weaknesses that we have in the system for refining and distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't show any weaknesses in crude because there are no weaknesses in crude, quite frankly. We can get all the crude we can get our hands on right now, and we need to get more of it domestically. But I want to remind your listeners that at the height of Katrina, wholesale gas prices went up to $2.60 a gallon. That's wholesale.
Wholesale.
That doesn't count profit and taxes
right.
distribution and so on and so forth. But people forget in December of 2004, George, wholesale gas prices were $1 a gallon. So they went from $1 to $2.60. Now they're back down to about $1.65 wholesale, $2.60 at the pump. And everybody's going, oh boy, we're much better off than we were. No, we're 60% higher than where we were just 10 months ago.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and George, it's going to have a ripple effect. All the truckers out there tonight that are driving, worried about how these huge costs for diesel fuel are impacting their lives. Well, everything, virtually everything we have in America has to be shipped by truck at some point or other.
Mm-hmm.
So as the costs of trucking fuel go up, that's going to have an impact on all the other goods and services that we buy.
Or it's also going to squeeze out these independent truckers who have their own small businesses.
Exactly.
They went out and financed their own cab, and their margins deal with the price of fuel. That's where their profit is. And if the price of fuel keeps going the way it is, they're going to get wiped out.
That's correct. And if their elected representatives that they sent to Washington, D.C. were to embrace the 7 steps that we outline in the back of this book, their prices would be down literally overnight. Because if the oil market saw tomorrow that the United States was serious about moving forward in this area and being the leader in this area, you'd see the prices drop overnight. Because we can beat the world at anything we set our minds to. We have the technology, we have the human resource and the natural resource and the capital markets to do it with.
Why did the price stay so high and is still high in Europe? Why is it up so high? What's going on there? And why haven't the people there simply been outraged over what's happening?
You know, as long as price is an interesting thing, as long as people will pay it, they're going to still continue to charge it. The distances are not as great in Europe as people drive. But the truth is, In the United States, where we have had traditionally lower costs of fuel with larger distances to drive, we've built a society based on having available cheaper fuel. That fuel is available.
Mm-hmm.
We could be oil independent. Like Craig pointed out, we wrote Black Gold Stranglehold with an action plan, seven steps that we've outlined that could get us oil independent today. And if your listeners and the readers call Congress, this is a plan that's going to affect their lives and change the situation where we can have reasonable prices of gas and heating fuel. The congressmen and senators will listen. Now, these offices, I've spent time in congressional offices. They're small. The staffs are overwhelmed. They start getting 20, 30, 40, 50 calls. That shuts everything down, and the congressmen listen. If the public gets on the phone and says we need more refineries, we need to implement these seven steps of the action plan in Black Gold Stranglehold, let's explore the abiotic theory of oil. Let's see if we can find more oil off the continental shelf. In Alaska and Canada combined, there's more oil there than in Saudi Arabia.
And aren't we sending oil from the Alaskan pipeline to Japan? Is that true?
Yes, we are exporting oil. We are an oil exporter as well as an oil importer.
I mean, we need it, but we're exporting it. And I bet we're making more money sending it out.
You're absolutely right. And what most people don't understand, George, is oil is fungible. If we get oil from the Middle East and we get oil from the Alaskan pipeline, it all goes into a big pot, so to speak.
Right.
We might ship a million barrels of that back overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So oil, like Jerry and I talk about in the book, more than likely we've probably had Iranian oil in America, even though we have an embargo against Iran because Iran probably sold it to, let's say, Gabon,
sure.
Or Gabon ultimately
well,
sold it to us.
That's how some of these companies, like Halliburton, they form a subsidiary offshore. That company then does work with Iran or did it with Iraq, and they get away with it. I guess it's the same way.
And, George, as long as we are dependent upon foreign countries, we write in the book and explain to the public that, for instance, Mexico, we import about 1.7 million barrels of oil from Mexico every day. Because we do that, we also then have a harder time closing our borders to illegal immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
The illegal immigrants that get in here from Mexico send money back home, and the foreign currency and the payments going back to Mexico from illegals working here is one of the largest sources of foreign currency for Mexico.
Sure. And the money they're sending back, the U.S. dollars they make here, must be huge compared with what they could make in Mexico.
They are huge. And then countries like Iran, who's a devoted enemy of the United States and Israel, they're getting $200 million a day in windfall oil profits. With that money, they can make weapons. So by our dependence upon foreign countries and keeping the price of oil high by not having refineries and getting the supply into the market, we're funding the enemies of the United States, including terrorists.
And we know for a fact now, George, in the war in Iraq, that a lot of the insurgency is being supported, and in some cases the actual physical bodies are coming from Iran to sponsor terrorism in the streets of Baghdad.
Well, and they've got then, if this is true, an endless supply of cash.
Exactly.
Because I've been saying, and I've talked with my friends, where are they getting the money for these weapons?
That's right.
Where are they getting it? Every one of them is armed.
Iran has nationalized their oil industry. They pay people very poorly. They've let the infrastructure deteriorate. $200 million a day coming into the mullahs. They're able to take that money, buy public relations and lawyers around the world
mm-hmm.
to keep themselves out of the Security Council, and buy weapons. And that's free cash flow to them.
Absolutely.
Because they do not have to share it with the workers. It does not enter their economy. They can get wealthy on it and come and fund terrorism.
Sure. And while this is happening, you've got countries like Japan that are making loans to the Iranians to develop their oil fields on the promises that the Japanese will ultimately get the oil that comes from those oil fields. So they will have unlimited sources of cash flow to be able to continue to sponsor terrorism throughout the world, which we know for a fact now intelligence is telling us is happening in the streets of Baghdad where we're losing American soldiers.
Many Iranians in this country whom I know who still call themselves Persians say that if you took a poll in Iran right now, without any ramifications. Most of the people in that country are westernized. They love the United States.
Very young,
these
too.
Aren't like the people of the 70s who backed the Ayatollah and they took over the embassy. It's the power structure of Iran that we have a problem with. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. When I wrote Atomic Iran and worked with the Iranian community, the Iranians in America are wonderful people. They are cultured, educated. They're successful. It's the same in Iran. The people are Persian culture and heritage, very productive. The mullahs who are running the country are criminals. They've hijacked Iran. They've hijacked Islam. And with the oil market where it is, and these windfall profits, $200 million a day, George, they can buy all the Europeans they want. They can buy public relations.
And I'm sure they're living very well, aren't they?
Living personally. High lifestyle, while the people in Iran are starving and on a subsistence level, children being sold into sex slavery. I mean, it's a disaster. It's like letting a criminal mafia run a country.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supported by high prices of oil in the world market. We wrote Black Gold Stranglehold to show the American public an action plan where we can take steps to get out of this, where we can become oil independent in the United States. We've called on the oil companies to, instead of just keeping these windfall profits, to reinvest the money in new refineries, to get the ability to put more supply into the system at a reasonable price.
You know, George, in writing the book, the thing that encouraged me the most was when I saw all the information, as we got deeper and deeper into the book, I got kind of discouraged. Because, I mean, all the information's there. And yet, when I saw that we truly have an opportunity as a nation to become completely energy independent, we have the ability to do it, all of a sudden I got excited. I got fired up because I want to see a change for my daughters, for Jerry's daughters. I mean, Jerry has a 10-year-old daughter. I have 21-year-old and 26-year-old. I'm a little bit younger, but kind of a little bit older than Jerry. and I see the future for America being where we lead the world in this area. I mean, George, we've got the technology, we've got the manpower, we've got the capital markets, we've got the natural resources. Why aren't we setting the example for the rest of the world? Why are we following? We should be leading, and
well,
we can do it.
And if you believe that this planet has an abundance of oil, that it's abiotic, that it creates it itself, if you believe that, and we're going to talk about global warming in a moment, if you believe that it's not contributing greatly to global warming, it may speed some things up a little bit because there are a lot of people on this planet, but I don't think it's the cause. I think we're in a cycle.
We get deeply into the question of global warming because the environmentalists have combined to say that by burning hydrocarbon fuels, we're putting more carbon dioxide into the air, and that's warming up the atmosphere and causing dramatic climate changes. Now, the truth is that about 99% of the atmosphere has nothing to do with carbon dioxide. It's mostly, you know, a combination of, it's mostly nitrogen is the mm-hmm. largest element in the air. 1% of the, less than 1% of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide.
I'll tell you, the biggest problem about that is knocking down the forests in the Amazon. You kill those trees that eat the carbon dioxide.
Well, you know, the irony is that the United States is reforesting. And the studies worldwide are that foresting is going on across the world because any additional carbon dioxide we're putting into the air can be absorbed by trees. As you said, George, the real warming that's going on has been a cycle going on for 1.8 million years where we go between glacial periods that recede into interglacial
yes.
periods.
And it will continue.
It will continue because anyone who wants to argue that human beings are the cause, now the Earth has been around over 4 billion years, and it's gone through huge numbers of changes that have had nothing to do with human beings. There's a great burden of proof to argue that the human beings are responsible for these changes. Right now, there are many scientists, as many, who say we could just as easily be going into global cooling period Absolutely. And the beginning of another ice age.
Robert Felix, whom we were talking about, believes we're in an ice age now.
Well, and the statistics show that if we didn't have increases of carbon dioxide, the Earth would actually be 60 degrees cooler Fahrenheit, which clearly wouldn't give us the growing seasons we have and so on and so forth to support human life on the planet the way we do today. So, you know, it's funny. When you do the research, George, all the information is there. And people just need – that's why I think the book will help people, because we put it in a very concise little package
right.
where people can read the facts and make their own decisions.
You know what's sad? Even with the ability to have as much oil as we need, if we had an alternative energy source that allowed people to basically have free energy to heat their homes, to air condition their homes, you know, at pennies on the dollar, which I think a technology exists, what a world this would be.
Mm.
I don't think that's going to ever happen.
Well, I think we can move much more towards reasonable prices if we take the seven steps we've outlined seriously and demand oil companies build more refineries and we get past the stranglehold of fear.
Let's talk about those seven steps when we come back. Jerry Corsi, Craig Smith, the book is called Black Gold, Stranglehold. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. In the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines and allow you to chat with both of them. I may also open up a special truckers hotline. No, not like the one we did on Friday night's open line. This will be just for truckers who want to react to the price of the diesel fuel they're spending their money on. I want to find out from you what life is like for you. We'll be back in a moment. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about superstition. So the next time you walk under a ladder, break a mirror, have a black cat run in front of you, make sure you're part of the program tomorrow. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Jerome Corsi and Craig Smith about Black Gold, Stranglehold. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls. Plus, we'll open up a trucker's fuel line just so you can tell us what life has been like for you with this increase of diesel fuel gasoline. Back in a moment. And you're back, and so am I. Jerry Corsi, our guest, Craig Smith. Jerry, Craig, if the planet is making its own oil, and we all believe it is, I think this planet always has a use for something. I mean, there's a reason for everything. The ozone layer is here for a reason. You know, oxygen is here for a reason. Oil in the planet, if it makes it itself, is there for a reason. What's the reason? Why does the planet create it?
Well, Thomas Gold, who we write about extensively, the Cornell astronomer who really got on to arguing that hydrocarbons are throughout the planetary system and beyond. Planets like Saturn has an enormous amount of hydrocarbons. On the Earth, Thomas Gold was arguing that hydrocarbons within the Earth are the food for the microbes and the various bacteria that are the basic forms of life.
Okay.
In fact, he even said, Thomas Gold made the statement, a very famous statement, saying that if you want to look for extraterrestrials and other planets, you'll probably find them within the planet before you'll find them on the surface of the planets. Eating away on the hydrocarbons that are within those planets, because it is a source of food that is basic to building life before photosynthesis on the surface of the planet, which is a much more complex process. So I think it's a very reasonable argument that hydrocarbons are fundamental, especially to beings like us that are basically built of carbon structures.
So you think it is a food source, then, for these microorganisms. What if we also take it a step further? What if the divine creator realized that human beings and life sources, when they get to a certain level of intelligence, well, they're going to need to use fuel. They're going to need energy, so we're going to put it in the planet. Much like it puts natural herbs. I was talking about saw palmetto on our Super Prostate commercial. The planet has that, and that specific herb does a number of things, including keeping one's prostate from enlarging.
Exactly.
Maybe this planet has certain things in it, ingredients, for survival. And that's one of its purposes.
I think you couldn't be any more right, George. I mean, think about it. Hydrocarbons are used for a source of energy to do a number of different things. What do we use as a source of energy in the human body? We use carbohydrates. Exactly. Hydrocarbons are just a different molecular structure of a carbohydrate.
Sure.
And so I agree with you. Every element that we needed to live for however long the great being wants us to be here, God wants us to be here, is here. That's why all we need to do is harvest it, maintain it, and use it. And that's why this whole nonsense, I mean, think about it. If we were running out of oil, we shouldn't use very much of it. I think just the opposite. We should use all of it and find more and use more of that.
Right.
And because the earth has this incredible ability to replenish itself. I remember in the first Gulf War, remember how it was at noontime. It looked like it was midnight with all the black soot in the air. And we were told it's going to destroy the atmosphere. Nobody's going to be able to breathe the air. Go over there now. The air is clean as could be.
Sure. And all those wells were capped and they're running again.
Yeah.
It would be, the earth would be like worrying about running out of oxygen. You know, the earth has an ability to replenish the supplies that we as human beings need and utilize. The reasonable concept would be, this is what never made sense to me about fossil fuels, is to why we were thinking that the advanced life form, which was dependent upon photosynthesis, hydrocarbons, carbohydrates, could go the other way and rot back into oil. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Especially in the quantity.
In the quantity.
That we've been using.
And that's what Dr. Thomas Gold said. He said, how could the carbohydrates then in turn be put back into the ground and turn back into hydrocarbons? I mean, the theories just don't hold up. And whenever you put them under scientific scrutiny, they fall apart. And that's what we did with the book. Jerry, in his research and in the first part of the book, basically said, I got to see if this can stand scientific scrutiny. And the more we dug into it, we realized it does not. And what we don't understand is, why aren't some of the oil companies and some of the scientists saying, we have to take this a tough approach on the theories and make sure it holds water, or we have to follow what Thomas Kuhn told us, and that is that if new evidence comes forward that blows an old theory apart, you've got to move on from that old theory and embrace the new theory.
Well, if I were the president of Exxon or BP or Shell, and I had black gold stranglehold, I'd be saying, look at this book, folks. Look what they've uncovered. We need to jump on top of this right away. We need to do this. We can capture the market. No, they already know this, don't they?
They know this. They're not making billions of dollars of investment in new infrastructures, putting the Gulf rigs that are now some of our major production of oil, is billions of dollars of infrastructure investment by the major oil companies. They're doing that because they know there's a huge amount of oil under the Gulf.
And we're going to use it for a long, long time.
A long, long time.
Sure. Just the other day, there was another $1 billion that was spent on what's called the Mardi Gras pipeline, which is a pipeline, a deep sea pipeline that's going to run from the rigs to the coast of Louisiana. Now, and it'll deliver about 1 million barrels a day. Why in the world would they spend $1 billion on that pipeline, George, if there was nothing to put in the pipeline?
I have been a proponent of hydrogen fuel primarily for this reason. To get our reliance away from foreign oil sources, because I think it's affected our political mindset and it's done some conspiratorial things that we can talk about a little bit later. However, if we believe that there's an endless supply of oil and we can tap into it without relying on some of these foreign countries that aren't really friendly to us, and I really believe it's not polluting the planet as much as other people think it is, there's no need to go to a hydrogen fuel source, is there?
There really is not. I mean, if you take a look at ANWR, that's like a postage stamp on the size of Alaska.
Right.
Exploring Alaska, there's probably a huge amount of oil deep underneath Alaska and
which,
Northern
by the way,
Canada.
Once belonged to the Soviet Union, right?
Exactly.
That would have been another reserve for them.
Another reserve. Yeah. And they've gone with using these theories of abiotic oil deep within the earth. Soviet Union has gone from a very small producer of oil to where it's the second largest producer in the world, right behind Saudi Arabia, finding huge quantities of oil deep within the earth. If we do the same offshore, we do the same in ANWR and in Alaska, begin exploring what we have deeper in the continental United States, and we can do it without polluting. I mean, everyone thinks, oh, the Exxon Valdez.
Sure.
Well, how about all the other oil tankers that didn't spill? How about going back to where the Exxon Valdez spilled and seeing how it's cleaned up? These disasters make an impact because the photographs and the news, but they're minor
right.
in relationship to the ability to safely, to the environment, go and produce energy.
The people who are pushing the peak oil theory, are there two camps? One camp being they're hardworking, dedicated people, scientists, researchers. They truly believe that fossil fuels are what oil has become, and they're pushing that theory. Or are they part of the conspiracy? You know, are they getting paid by big oil to create this fear?
I personally believe that some of the people are very sincere in their beliefs. Unfortunately, they're sincerely wrong. And all they have to do is look at the evidence. So one would have to take the next step from that and say, if the evidence is so obvious, there must be another motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jerry and I are working on another book right now where we're going to be talking about following the money. You know, there's an old saying.
That's what I say all the time.
If you want to find
follow
out.
Follow the money, you'll know what's going on.
You bet. And you said it
you
earlier.
You can quote in the book.
Well, you said it earlier in the first hour, George, and you're right. The oil companies are setting record profits. Now, I have no problem with that if they're putting that money back into infrastructure and can tell me, Craig, a year, two, three, we're going to bring the price back down under $2
they're
a gallon
not doing
and get
that.
You. Well, maybe they will if we encourage them to do that.
True.
But we're not hearing that yet. And I hope we do hear that without the government being involved. Because mm-hmm. you heard the GOP, Denny Hassert, the other day saying we're going to have to tax you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Or spend the money.
Right.
Right. We wrote the book, George, in order to show people not problems but solutions, so that we've defined an action plan to get refineries into place, to begin new research on demonstrating that oil can be found deep within the earth and under the waters of the earth, to provide structures and tax credits for getting more refineries in place and cut the red tape so we can get refineries built. The positive solutions start with people changing their mindset and realizing, you know, the planets aren't all revolving around the Earth. That's that old Copernicus theory held up for so long. Well, also, oil is not fossil fuel. It's produced by the Earth. It's available. We can find it. It's imperative that our government officials know what's in the book. People who are suffering out there, all of us, paying exorbitant prices for gasoline and heating fuel, truckers suffering, which is going to impact prices from every consumer good we have in the economy. These are impacts that don't need to be. We can get more supply of oil and heating fuel into the economy efficiently, cheaply, and without ruining the environment.
And they could still make some money.
And they can still make some money.
I mean, this is good economics. I mean, when you think about it, if you can produce more energy more cost-effectively, have an endless supply, not be dependent on other suppliers. I mean, just think about it from an economics 101
Absolutely.
Standpoint. It makes good sense from a CEO who's trying to take care of his shareholders.
Sure.
Right, but the key element in this is that the people listening have to understand the power is in their hands.
That's right.
The ability to call Congress, the ability to make the statements, not to get the government involved and regulate. You know, under Jimmy Carter, we had price controls and all of those, and it was a disaster. But to get responsible action from the oil companies where we can see progress in the infrastructure of oil so we can move to the United States being oil independent instead of having 60% imported from foreign sources that can then bludgeon us, like Mexico.
And they are.
And they are. Venezuela. Let's go to 40% imported. We've got natural gas now. 80% of it we find here. Let's increase the use of natural gas. Let's increase the use of nuclear power. These are things that do work, that we can put online, and we can move in the direction of becoming more independent again and not dependent upon foreign countries who only want to take a massive shift of our wealth from here to other countries in the world, with us doing what they want in order to keep their favor so we keep getting their oil.
Do you really believe oil's going to head toward $5 or $10 a gallon?
George, we saw it happen when we had Hurricane Katrina come through. In Atlanta, it was $5. Our refineries now are limited. The damage done to the refineries was excessive. if that damage was done by this last one that came through, Wilma went on a different path. And
right. That would have been it.
Would have been it. I mean, we three blows like that in our refining capacity, and we could be put to more than $5 a gallon without the ability to have a backup plan. We really do not have an energy plan in the United States. Saying conserve is not a plan.
No, it has never worked.
It has never worked.
Well, and you know, you remember, George, during Hurricane Katrina when President Bush said he would open up the 700 million barrels of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It did little to move the gasoline prices to the downside because it wasn't a question of getting crude. It was a question of getting refined product and getting it distributed.
Sure.
It's not just refining it. We also have to get it to those gasoline pumps.
Yeah, that's true. And we'll find out soon enough from some of these truckers who are driving trucks that it's difficult to do that at these prices.
Very much so.
That's right. You know, George, if we look at the drifting of the market without any clear direction, it moves in the direction of saying, okay, we'll just import more oil, and everyone is feeling fear. They're going to say we're running out of it. It's a great formula for just charging more prices and having excessive profits. Now, that's a formula that's going to go nowhere.
Right.
That's going to be a disaster. We wrote Black Gold Stranglehold to say, look, we've put the stranglehold on ourselves. First, let's get our mindset here correct, that oil is abundant. We've got 1.2 trillion barrels of oil, more than ever in history. That's not consistent with fossil fuel, the peak theories, and that we're running out. Let's get more refineries built so that the oil companies take these profits and put them back into getting oil online in a reasonable way. Let's educate the public to show them the political dangers we're under if oil continues to escalate in price and we have to import, even from countries like Mexico, where we then can't turn around and have a policy that limits the amount of illegal immigration we have because we don't want the oil shut off from Mexico. That's why we wrote the book. Craig and I wanted to bring to the attention of everyone listening tonight that it is within your hands to end the stranglehold and to demand effective action from Washington.
And you know, also, though, until you can get some of these elitists who run these companies who could care less about people, and that's also what it comes down to, because they're making their zillion-dollar salary. They're getting their stock options. They have their mansions. They have their cars. They have their butlers. They have their limousine services. They have all those fine things that true wealth provides them. They have their many homes. I don't know if they care about people. They don't care if people are struggling at $3 a gallon because they're okay. They're in their own little world, and nobody can get to them.
There's a lot of people listening tonight who, instead of putting $50 or $75 into the gas tank to fill up the car or the SUV or the pickup truck, have to put in just as much to get them to the next place they're going to.
Yes.
And that's something Americans should not have to live under, that kind of stranglehold fear.
Fearing that if you're stuck in a traffic jam, you could run out of fuel on the freeway.
It happened when people were leaving Houston. It happened when people were leaving New Orleans. And, you know, when I go to a gas station now, George, I generally engage the person who's pumping gas next to me, and I talk to him. You'd be surprised the response you get to that cotton-picking president. He's ruined, you know, and they'll blame everything from the president to the oil companies. And I start to think to myself, little does that fella pumping the gas realize that he is part of the problem. But more importantly, he's part of the solution. That if he can change his thinking just a little tiny bit and engage his elected representatives, we can create an environment where this won't be an issue. You know, you're talking about hydrogen, and you know, most people don't realize that hydrogen will work, but it takes a lot of energy to release the energy from the hydrogen, massive tanks to put in your car, which would increase weight and stuff. But most people are thinking along those lines because they think we're running out of oil.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. That's the first concern. It's not the environment. It's the fact and the fear that we're running out and we're being strangled by foreign countries.
Right. So if we start with just that simple a basis that we're not running out, and as Jerry said, let's build more refineries. Let's educate the public about what's going on. Let's bring scientific research to the forefront. All of a sudden, people will get away from the fear, George, because they'll say, hey, We're on to something. We have a plan. You know, most people will follow a leader that has a plan.
Right.
Says we're going from here to here, and here's how we're going to get
and
there.
We're going
to
do it.
And America will rally behind that. My goodness, we fought the Second World War on that.
We got to the moon that way. You know, one of my favorite movies, the movie Network, there's a fellow in there called Howard Beale. And he opened up the windows one day on his television studio and said, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And maybe we need that now, too.
Amen. Well, George, that's why we wrote Black Gold Stranglehold, so people can take this, hold it up, and say, we're not going to take this anymore. There's always fear is the worst, most incapacitating emotion human beings have. If we feel fear, we don't know where to go, what's going to happen. And there's always been doomsayers since Malthus told us too many a population were going to outlive the food supply.
Yeah.
In creative thinking, there is innovation. There is supply available. We've got more crude oil now than ever in the history of the world. Let's refine it. Let's move ahead with effective prices we can live with.
And I'll tell you, the big mistake the fear mongers have created is rather than sprinkle fear every once in a while, they've somehow decided to do it all at one time, and that's going to be a problem. We'll be back in a moment. We'll open up. Jerry, Craig, when do you think the lie started? When do you think Big Oil, whoever might be behind this, started to concoct the push toward scarcity, that we're coming to the end?
It's been going on as long as I've been alive. It's been going on, really, since the first oil wells were discovered in America. When Hubbard did the peak oil theory in the 50s, I think
that he worked for Shell.
He worked for Shell.
Right.
The whole concept was if grabbing a hold of this idea that oil was fossil fuel, it made it inevitable that we would run out of oil because there were only so many dinosaurs. And what a better marketing campaign could there be to convince people it was scarce and it needed to cost a lot.
Well, you mean at that point people were thinking oil came from fossil fuels, or was that way beyond that?
It goes back, if you trace the history, it goes back to about 1757 when a Russian scientist, Lomonosov, said that in just a couple sentences, because oil they knew had biological debris in it, they said, well, it had to come from dinosaurs.
Oh, okay. So a Russian started biotic and abiotic.
Exactly.
And what I find interesting is that the fellow that came up with the abiotic theory, Dmitry Mendeleev, went on to produce the 66 elements of the periodic tables, which we all know
sure.
as rock-solid science. We base all of our science on
yep.
that, for Pete's
yep.
sakes. So who would have more credibility, the fellow that you don't can't even remember his name or mm-hmm. pronounce it, mm-hmm. or Mendeleev, that we all know from his, something as simple as science in high school.
See, I sometimes thought that with the planet in its with its core, in the core we all know is spinning,
mm-hmm.
that maybe oil is part of that lubricant that keeps it going.
Interesting.
I mean, that's my little theory.
It's synthesized. It's a combination of putting together carbon and hydrogen elements. And it forms probably in the mantle of the Earth, at least this is Thomas Gold's theories, as a gas.
Mm-hmm.
So there's deep gas hydrocarbon formations that come up through into the Earth, actually lie below the crystalline basement, and then seep through that into fissures,
right.
into the sedimentary rocks. Remember, the chemical formation is like taking water, H2O. I mean, it can be ice. It can be
steam.
Water, it can be steam. So you've got hydrocarbons, which are just different combinations of hydrogen and carbon atoms together. There could be methane, it could be formed into crude oil, it could be a variety of different manifestations of hydrocarbon products formed initially as gases coming up through the mantle of the Earth. That seems to be the basic scientific theories that the Soviets used after World War II, to find oil deep within the Earth and to advance themselves to be the second largest oil-exporting nation in the world.
Interesting. I'd love to get... Have you confronted Big Oil yet with these theories?
To a limited degree, and their minds are closed. You know, it's in any new theory, people initially have to get a little over the shock. Once they start thinking about it, like, you know, how did the dinosaurs actually rot into oil? Nobody's been able to take a decaying body material and ancient ferns or decaying plants and make them back into oil. You know, you bury an animal and it turns out to be returned dust into dust.
Well, even if you could believe that, there's no way, even billions of years ago, we were 3 or 4 miles deep on this planet. I mean, we can't have accumulated that much dirt and crud on this planet.
Like you said, George, we're finding huge amounts of oil in the oceans. Did the dinosaurs all swim out there and drown and then drop to the bottom? I mean,
exactly.
We find very few dinosaur bones in Saudi Arabia, but we find all the oil in Saudi Arabia. We find a lot of dinosaur bones in Montana, but we don't find much oil up there.
Let's go to the phones. You ready?
Yes.
We'll pick up. Let's go to our special trucker fuel line. First of all, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. And where are you driving through at this point?
Oh, I'm a little less than an hour south of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
So we have them verify, Jerry and Craig, that they're indeed truckers by honking their horn, right?
Yes. You want to hear my horn?
I sure do.
Hold on a second.
There it is. There it is. Okay, take it away, Matt. So what's life been like for you, fuel-wise?
Oh, it's very frustrating. I'm really strongly considering parking my truck and driving for somebody else.
Wow.
I can't take this high price of fuel anymore.
It's going to put you out of business?
Well, it'll make me change my business for sure.
At what point does it become profitable again for you to really want to drive?
Well, it's profitable. It's just the margins are depleted dramatically.
How many people are affected by this if you decide to park the truck? I mean, it's obviously your mechanic, but a wife, children. I mean, how many other people are dependent on your income to help them get along in life?
I don't have a wife or a family, so it's just me. But I'll still continue to drive because that's what I'm best at and that's what I know. But I'll just park the truck until the fuel prices come down where I can make it profitable again.
Well, and I'm sure we're going to see it at the stores, aren't we?
Oh, definitely. I can't imagine. I mean, I just talked to a person today. I'm going to be hauling recycled plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had a part of their business that recycled paper, and they shut that part of the business down because there was no profit left for them after they paid for the increase in transportation.
That's a good point. Hey, thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
You know, he just brought up a good point, George. He's talking about trucking recycled plastics.
Which is oil.
Well, that's naphtha. When we break oil, when we crack oil, we get naphtha, which is where we get all of our plastic products from. And think about how much plastic we use on a daily basis.
Huge. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's great to talk with you.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
I'm calling from listening to WGOW in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yes, you are.
I love that station. Anyway, guys, I just wanted to make just a suggestion, see where y'all stand on this. Wouldn't it be a good plan just to try to embrace some of the alternative energy forms, maybe even a multitude to so-called diversify our energy solutions for the future so that we get a beginning dip our big toe into some of the future energy sources so that, you know, we can just get on that road and maybe gas and hydrogen and ethanol could all contribute, right?
You've got an excellent point. I mean, I think we're in favor of exploring alternatives. We have to be careful that the windmills that are up across the country, the windmills kill the birds. These are trade-offs. Ethanol takes hydrocarbon, oil, various energies to transform corn or other grain products into ethanol. So it's not like these technologies have come forward and are really alternatives yet.
It surely couldn't take nearly as much energy as putting it on a big barge and shipping it all the way across the ocean. I mean, that's got to take great amounts of energy in itself right there. I mean, isn't it just a matter of centralization and decentralization of energy? Wouldn't you just be honest and admit that?
I think you've got an excellent point that we should explore alternatives.
Okay.
And I think that we in the book are in favor of exploring alternatives.
Yeah, we don't by any stretch of the imagination suggest that we abandon all the research we're doing in hydrogen, wind, solar, nuclear, or any of the other alternative ethanol, any of the alternative energies. What we're saying is while we're pursuing that and while we're getting the cost down, just like we did when we built VCRs, they were $900, now they're $90. As we pursue the technology and the prices come down, maybe they will make great alternatives in the future. But until that time, we have plenty of oil to use, and let's not try and scare the American public that we're running out, because we're not.
Venezuela, the price of gasoline there is what, like 14 cents a gallon?
Yeah, actually it's a little more. It's about 25 cents a gallon right now.
It must have jumped.
Yeah. And
even they got hit.
But that's a great example, George. Why can Hugo Chavez, who, by the way, owns Citgo and the 16,000 outlets that are tied
to... Now, when you say he owns it, or
well,
owns
I,
it
say,
or Venezuela?
I say for the nation
who
of Venezuela.
Who is he right now? That's
right.
True.
He's in charge.
14,000 stations out there.
Right. And you know, it was interesting. He was going to make low-price gas available to low-income Americans as his contribution to this nation that he so much hates,
yeah.
You know. But anyway, why can he produce gasoline for his citizens at that price when the greatest nation on the face of the earth charges $3 a gallon? Doesn't make any sense to me.
$4.25, even at $0.25. Do you imagine what people would do with their disposable income if they were only paying 25 cents a gallon? First of all, mentally, they'd be going out to restaurants more than they're going. They would be buying cars. They would be fueling the economy with cash.
Absolutely.
And, George, the next shoe is going to hit fall when people have to pay their heating bills.
You're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I know a 69-year-old lady in St. Louis, Jerry. She's on a fixed income. She gets a Social Security check. She's all by herself. And she cannot handle a 30 to 40% increase in natural gas.
That's right. There's going to be people cold.
And I think it's going to be a cold winter.
And people are going to be cold. They're going to be saying, which rooms do we shut down and not go into? These are decisions that don't have to be being made if we follow what we wrote in Black Gold Stranglehold. We take the steps, we get more refineries online, and we get more supply online.
And let me tell you, George, you allow a few of these lower-income elderly people to die in house fires because mm-hmm. they use space heaters, what have you.
Right.
And then the media will jump on this because there will be people that lose their lives.
Or they
as
freeze to death.
Exactly.
Yeah. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Johnny calling from Northridge.
Hey, Johnny, Northridge, California, to people who might not know. Go ahead.
Well, George, I'm a little bit concerned. It seems like you've been more leaning towards deciding, making your opinion that we don't need to pursue hydrogen.
Oh, no. You didn't listen to me. I said the first thing we have to decide is if this entire situation is indeed true, that the oil comes from within the planet and we've got an unlimited amount, and also that it's not polluting the environment as much as environmental say it is, which I believe it is not, then we should at least relax a little bit, as long as we're producing it. My biggest push is to get away from our reliance on Middle Eastern and foreign oil from countries that are causing severe problems for us. That's my first goal. The next goal, of course, is, yes, we need alternative energy, and quite frankly, we need free energy if we can ever get it. Had Tesla been alive, we might have had that by now. So don't misunderstand what I've said about that.
Well, it's not that. The problem I have is that people continually with the Bush administration and the influence he has, it seems like less emphasis is being put on our effect. And one of the biggest things that people don't point out too often is the carbon dioxide emissions from the ocean. One thing that's very true is the hotter the atmosphere gets, the glacial melt changes the water levels and the salinity in our ocean.
True.
With the plant life in the oceans aren't able to use the carbon dioxide as efficiently as they're able to, and more carbon dioxide escapes time and time from the oceans. And then the other part of my point is one of the biggest plant life that has a major effect on it in ocean life is our coral reefs. And it's amazing if you look into the research about that, about how much we've lost and that through losing our coral reefs, we're emitting more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's simple. The salinity goes up, coral reefs die, the water levels go up, and the salinity, there's not as much pressure to keep the carbon dioxide at lower levels in the water, and the plants being able to, you know, use photosynthesis to exchange it and produce oxygen out of it.
And you know, though, that this has happened before, way before mankind was even around.
Now, I absolutely believe that, but the cycle I speak of, it's a cycle that continues. The more we emit carbon into our atmosphere, the more this happens. I mean, the more carbon dioxide that gets produced up here, then it has the effect on the oceans and so forth. So, I mean, it's a cycle that is not reversing itself, and humans do have a major effect on that cycle.
We disagree.
So that's one of my biggest concerns. Now, I certainly must say, I mean, I'm about to graduate with a degree in marine biology and pursuing organic chemistry, but putting myself through school, I'm a contractor in the state of California, a building contractor, and the cost of gas and oil is just killing me right now.
Okay, and let's get the reaction to your points from Jerome or Craig.
Well, the one key thing in terms of the planet heating up is that, you know, for instance, in the oceans, the amount of energy it's going to take to raise the oceans 2 or 3 degrees. If you look at the underwater volcanic activity, a lot more energy coming from that, and there's good science that's the cause of oceans warming. The amount of carbon dioxide that's put into the planet by automobiles burning gasoline is minuscule. It's a small fraction. First of all, you know, only less 0.4% of the atmosphere itself is carbon dioxide, and trees would absorb it. We have a tendency to overestimate the impact of human beings. 70% of the planet is oceans. You know, all the human beings in the world put together don't occupy very much space. We tend to think we're of huge impact, and in some over 4 billion years of Earth history, there's been a lot of changes when human beings weren't around at all.
And even on that 30% land mass that's available, human beings are on even a smaller amount of that.
We probably occupy 10% of the surface of the Earth.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people think that if we could gather every citizen in the world and put them in the City of Angels, Los Angeles, and we all were to jump up and down at the same time, we'd throw the planet out of its orbit.
Well, except
the answer is no, it wouldn't
happen.
Except
they are all here during rush
hour. We experienced that today coming to your studio, George.
There are not enough dinosaurs to fuel the cars that we saw today in the freeways.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, George and Jerry and Craig. Well, I think a lot of the environmental movement has been confused by what, in fact, is the problem in terms of our atmosphere and carbon dioxide. The more recent discussions have involved the particulates, and that's by way of the burning of coal directly, and so that's been clamped down on many discussions concerning that. But I'm very concerned about the alternative energy direction in light of the power and money-hungry, mad folk out there that simply want to make a buck, even though the energy is virtually free. And so our public interest should be clamoring to get a charge of the technology. I note with interest the development of a program the other day with DeBuhaw and the development of this Pierce Arrow radiant energy tapping device, where it just picked up energy. It drove for days, 90 miles an hour, no battery in it whatsoever, but that's not going to be seen here. And so we're going to say, well, let's discuss how the impact on the environment's had by way of fossil fuels, but we'll give over to these same characters virtually, because a lot of these interests have gained control of some of the alternative energy areas, and say they're going to save us. They'll charge us through the nose for this stuff, even though it's free from the wind or from fiber technology with Sir Charles Schultz III on some months ago. I don't trust these guys, and I think the public interests should be clamoring to get control of this, to get back our grid. And quite frankly, if we allow them to run the day, we're not going to get any further ahead than we have for the past few decades.
You know, I would love to be able to have a system where I could create my own energy for my house, wherever I live, and just take care of myself that way. Wouldn't that be so cool?
There are some people that do that in Northern California where I have a ranch. Yep. There are many people that are solar self-sufficient with battery backups.
And they put it back on the grid, the excess power. We'll be back in a moment. Final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Let's move on to West of the Rockies and see what's on your mind. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hey.
George, this is a question for both authors.
Okay, sir. Go ahead.
Well, last hour you asked them about Europe and how come the prices are so high and why don't they do anything about it. That was one question. And the other one was, can they go into more detail about how these building blocks are produced, what the temperature's like, and what happens when those little microbes eat the oil? What do they produce? Like, could they go into that kind of that? I'll take the question off the air.
Okay, thanks a lot. For European oil, again, $5 plus per gallon doesn't seem to be an outrage.
No, and I think Europeans don't use as much gas as we do. The distances aren't as large, and they've adapted to it. I think the problem here is that we've had cheaper energy, and with oil at $3 a gallon or potentially more, it's going to put extreme hardship on a lot of people, and it is already.
Well, then let's do a reversal in terms of pharmaceuticals. We pay outrageous prices for drugs in this country, but in Canada... In Mexico, same pill is much cheaper.
Perfect example. And if you go to Europe, if you travel in Europe, you know that most people drive smaller cars because the roadways are smaller. Mm-hmm. Parking is a nightmare. And as Jerry said, people just don't use as much. So when they buy it by the liter and they're not using a whole lot of it, if you're not driving like in L.A. where people are driving 50, 60 miles round trip to work, you don't really feel the effects of it. And plus, Europe is not very well known for having great refining capacity. Mm-hmm. So once again, you know, if I'm sure they could do a lot better if they built their own refineries and did what we did in America. People forget we refine. Of the 21 million barrels a day that we get of oil, we refine over 15 million barrels of that into different distillants,
that's
petroleum. We do an incredible job considering we've shut down 300 refineries and consolidated all that capacity.
Right.
We're running at about 96 to 98% capacity right now. So Europe could clearly have cheaper prices if they were moving the direction.
That's why you can't take a hurricane hit, I guess.
Exactly. Right? As I said in one of the hours before, George, all hurricanes Katrina and Rita did was expose a problem that's been existing in this nation for 25 years. We're now seeing what happens when you run a nation without a comprehensive energy policy and with no vision for the future of where you're going.
And no president has done that for us.
It's really, as Ronald Reagan once said, just using less energy is not a policy.
That's right. You know. What about these microbes? After they gobble up some of the oil, what happens?
Well, the microbes, the oil deep within the earth, the microbes can live on the oil, and they actually, many of them, incorporate themselves into the oil. That's why oil, when it has a microbiotic content to it, was originally thought, well, it had to come then from living organisms.
I see.
And the microbes give oil its microbiotic content as the oil passes up through the earth from deep within the earth.
And we're also realizing by studying the deep sea vents and the tube worms at the bottom of the ocean floors, some 2,500 to 5,000 feet below the waterline. Of course, there's no sunlight there, so there's no photosynthesis creating cellular structure. Yet we're finding tube worms and clams and all this deep biosphere that we didn't realize existed, and we're finding out that they're actually being fed and growing off hydrocarbons that are being emitted from the surface of the ocean or the floor of the ocean. And of course, you know, years ago, the Bermuda Triangle, there was many people that thought maybe there were these big belches of gas that came up from the floor of the ocean that sucked these ships down. I don't know if that's true or not. But the bottom line is we know that these gases that are being released from the floors of the ocean are creating all kinds of abundant life where there is no sunlight.
These oil rigs that are in the ocean, in the sea, from the top of the sea surface down to the ocean floor, how deep are we talking, and then how deep have they drilled?
That's where you're getting down to maybe 2 miles to hit the bottom of the ocean, and then maybe another mile and a half or 2 miles down. You can go 3-4 miles down, but George, you've got an excellent point.
Well, go ahead. I'll let you finish that.
The excellent point is that one offshore drilling is so effective because going through the water, you get down faster,
yes,
easier. And you're hitting areas where there's no expectation that there ever were dinosaurs,
mm-hmm,
or ancient forests. But you're getting into the deep biosphere quicker.
Now, when they hit oil, whether it's on land or in the sea, do they stop drilling the minute they hit it and it spouts out, or do they keep going down a little bit more?
Typically, they stop and take that oil, and that's it.
So in theory, it could be 1 mile down underneath that. It, once they've hit the surface of it, it could be 10 yes, miles of oil.
Yes,
right?
We write about a couple in specific, this Eugene 333 in the Gulf, where they did exactly that, George. They took the first oil out and they stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil replenished itself.
Right.
And they realized there was another reservoir below what they thought was only one reservoir. Well, it ends up being about three reservoirs down there because of the fissures down into the earth. Let the oil come back up. It had been pooled there. It replenished itself when drilled out. And I think that it's a key issue going back to areas that have been drilled out and say, where did that oil really come from? Because originally we assumed, well, that's where the dinosaurs lay dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if it isn't the dinosaurs laying dying, it came from deep within the earth, and there may be reservoirs.
How do these scientists who believe in the biotic fuel source, what's their argument for the dinosaurs in the plant life, for oil creation, when it's found 10 or 15,000 feet underground? What do they say about that?
A lot of practical geologists and oil engineers around the world have given up thinking about dinosaurs. And quite frankly, the members of my family from Argentina have been in the oil industry,
yeah,
and they think it's ridiculous that Americans think that oil came from dinosaurs.
I mean, we know that throughout the millennia there can't be 15,000 feet of strata that has accumulated because people didn't dust their homes. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And, of course, obviously, I'm trying to be a little ridiculous about my comments, George, but everything inside my human experience tells me that the dinosaur theory makes no sense. But intuitively, it makes complete sense to me that the Earth, when it was formed, we were given everything
abundance,
as human beings, of
absolutely,
everything we need.
Absolutely. And it may be, here's the other thing. You know, we've talked about it being part of the planet, a normal part of the planet. We really haven't touched on the fact that maybe it's still creating it more and more and more.
Yes, I that's what Thomas Gold believed, and the Soviet scientists back to the 50s did too. It's constantly under production, hydrocarbons manufactured by the Earth. Now, one other point that popped in my mind, we wrote about, they say that we hear about the dinosaurs all died in tar pits. Well, which came first, the tar pits or the dinosaurs?
Good point. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning. Where are you?
Just fine. How are you gentlemen today?
Good.
Let me prove I'm a trucker here for you.
Yes, you are. Or you have a very loud horn in your car, but we believe you.
I'm driving up from Laredo, approaching Waco, and I'm willing to accept the fact that diesel fuel now costs more than unleaded because of the new regulations for cleaner burning fuel. But my question is this. I passed the station in Laredo, and regular unleaded was at $2.19 a gallon, while diesel was at $3.15 a gallon. Why such a huge disparity?
Somebody's making a lot of money on it.
You know,
that's why.
We discussed this during one of the breaks, and our personal belief, or at least mine is that oil companies are in the business to sell to the highest bidder, and people are paying $3 a gallon, so they're selling it for $3 a gallon. It's like Canada said, you don't play ball with us the right way, we'll sell our oil to China. And, you know, this is part of the active free market that we have with oil. And quite frankly, George, that's why you've seen prices on gasoline drop somewhat, because when prices got above $3 a gallon, demand as a natural cause of market forces dropped because people couldn't afford to buy gasoline.
Well, and they were afraid, the oil companies were a little concerned that that the masses weren't going to take too much of this.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But when I left Arizona, it was $2.80 a gallon. I got to the border, it was $2.90. In Solana Beach, it's $3.25. Yeah. It's all the same station, same gasoline.
You're going to list your house for $300,000 or $299,000.
Exactly. Know? And if somebody's willing to pay $300,000, then I guess that's what you get for the house. And I think that's what's happening. I don't think it's fair to people like this lady that's calling in, because she can't go negotiate with the fella at the station there. She has to pay it. And that's where I think it's high time that not the government, but the public, the marketplace, put the pressure on these people saying, hey, maybe we're just not going to buy some diesel for a day or two to show you that we mean business.
What if all the truckers in this country, these wonderful people in this glorious country, simply said, you know what, for this day on a Monday, we're not driving?
It would change overnight.
Yep.
Maybe they should all drive to Washington. You know, one of the things I think could change things is just for the phone calls into Congress. The woman who just called in driving toward Waco made an excellent point, because the money that's going in at this $3 for diesel is going into the profits right now of the oil companies. The oil companies are going to have to show responsibility to increase supply. Where are the new refineries being built? We haven't had one built in 30 years. We have no government policy right now. Government policy, let's build all the refineries, or 60% of them, in the Gulf, so when hurricanes come through, which they do regularly, our refining capacity gets wiped out. That's not a government policy. So we wrote the book to give people the tools, the information, to create responses from government, not so government takes over, but so that the oil industry begins responsibly increasing supply and getting prices to a reasonable level.
You know, George, we show in the book that if you involve the governments in the solution, it will really make things worse. I mean, we saw that with Nixon with wage and price controls and Jimmy Carter in the 70s. So this isn't going to be a direct result of people getting involved. That's why we tried to make the book a resource that people could understand the science, so that the common person could understand it and say, hey, this makes sense, and then give them the ability to be able to talk intelligently about it to some extent with their elected representatives and with other people, because that's what the beautiful part about Coast to Coast. You're educating millions of people about something that most people knew in their heart was right, but they didn't know where to go to prove it.
Shell Oil Company is a big company, right?
Right.
Very huge big company.
Huge.
It's Dutch-owned, isn't it?
That's right.
The Netherlands, that's a small country. I'm not even sure they have a lot of oil there. My point is how can a company like Shell, owned, be a Dutch company? Is it a tax haven, or what's going on with that? I don't understand.
Well, you're onto a very important point. British Petroleum is a British company. You know, Britain doesn't have an excess of oil.
Right.
Of course, they've been, since the colonial times, they've been trying to go grab all the oil they can find all over the world.
So how did BP, for example, get as big as it is?
Well, through, again, getting these international contracts and keeping the price of oil high by convincing people that oil is scarce and that we're going to run out of it. There's 1.2 trillion barrels of proven reserves in the world today, more than ever in human history. The bottleneck, the stranglehold, is the refining capacity. We have not built a new refinery in 30 years. Our refineries are operating at 96, 97% capacity. There's plenty of crude oil around. It can't get into the system. And if the oil companies want to just sit on windfall profits, that's a very bad formula. For people driving to Waco, Texas, paying $3 for diesel fuel, and seeing that Chevron is reporting record profits, that's just not going to sit.
Why does Venezuela own its own oil? Iran owns its own oil. Saudi Arabia owns its own oil. But the United States doesn't. How can that be?
Over decades, we've been convinced that we've used all the oil in America and that the environmentalists have just gotten out of control with being not willing to allow exploration to go on for the oil that we do have. We change our concepts. We realize that there is plenty of oil. We go after what's available in Alaska, what's available offshore, what's available deeper within the continental United States. we can begin reducing our dependence on foreign oil from 60% now imported. Let's go to 50% imported. Let's go to 40% imported. Let's get more oil online from our available supplies.
Well, where is BP, British Petroleum, getting its fuel that it then sells all around this planet?
Well, see, this is something that you hit on earlier that I think we should elaborate on. You talked about, you know, how do these companies that are offshore do what they do?
Yeah.
They use the American capital markets in a very efficient way. BP is a stock that you can buy in the New York Stock Exchange. So they gain these, they get this capital, then they go to these foreign countries and develop reserves.
So they're developing oil where? Everywhere?
Everywhere.
Russia. Kazakhstan,
all the places we mentioned.
Iran.
Sure, because they're not under embargo to
Iran.
And
they pay then the government of Iran to take out the oil? Is that how that works?
In the case of Iran, you have the Bank of Japan that's made them a $3 billion loan, and I think another $3 billion negotiated.
What good is OPEC in setting prices when it's the companies like British Petroleum that's getting all the oil first?
You've hit upon an extremely important point. The oil market is so grown, and oil is fungible. Once it enters the system, you don't know where it comes from.
Right.
So BP can go out and buy oil from wherever it wants to for the lowest price it can arrange. Then it can turn around and put that into the world market, usually the United States, at the highest price it can get. And as long as we're convinced that we're running out of oil and can't have any here, well, BP is free to go and take foreign oil and bring it in here at high prices.
So the evil may not be these countries. It may be indeed some of these oil companies.
Or a combination of both.
Or they're in cahoots with each other.
Well, think about it. Saudi Arabia, when they saw these prices go high, they said, we're going to open up the spigots. And did it bring the prices down?
No.
Not one individual can affect this market because, as Jerry said, it's a fungible market. And there are now more users than there are producers. And we can change that.
It's a club. And, George, you asked them. Important question earlier, you know, whether how big oil is going to react to this book. Black Gold Stranglehold is not going to be a well-received book by Chevron and Exxon. They are not going to like us telling the American people that oil has nothing to do with fossils and it's abundant.
And the price is ridiculous.
And the price is ridiculous. Exactly. That's not a message big oil wants told to America.
It's what we say on the cover of the book. We ask the question, why are gas prices so high?
So politically, when we talk about going to war with all these other countries, meanwhile, you have British Petroleum, Shell, and all these other companies dealing with these guys on a buddy-buddy relationship.
That's right. Chevron's made major investments in Russia to get oil. The oil companies work internationally.
They're like a government to themselves.
They're like their own independent super government. And they're finding oil where they can get it at the cheapest prices and putting it largely in the United States at high prices.
And I'm sure some of these guys were friends with Saddam Hussein at the time.
Well, there's no question about it. And when you look at the oil for food scandals that were going on and the prices that were being cheated out of there, you realize that there is a pressure on keeping oil prices high to benefit these oil companies and special interests that benefit from them. And what we want the people to realize is if oil is available, if it can be put online reasonably with more refineries, we can break the stranglehold of large companies acting this way that we've self-imposed on us.
It is amazing. It's like the Illuminati. Yeah. And the oil companies are all in cahoots.
It really is. That's why we want people to read the book to see it for themselves.
We've got an hour to go. You're going to stick around for more phone calls.
Absolutely.
This has been a lightning fast night. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, every once in a while, Jerry and Craig, when I travel, I try to read a good book on plane because to me, 2 hours, 3 hours, let's get something done. I hate idle time. Black Gold Stranglehold is the kind of book that you don't want to waste your time not reading it. And it's a perfect opportunity for people, too, if they're traveling, if they're in hotels, if they're just staying at home. Because the message is very important. And I think one thing it does, which is very interesting, in spite of the problems we're having, it kind of makes you feel good that it's not all doom and gloom at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, there are answers, and there are practical solutions. I mean, this is probably one of the most fixable issues that this country has ever faced. And that's, we got excited as we got towards the end of the book, drawing our conclusions and coming up with, it was almost like a light bulb went off one day when we were working on it. It's like, hey, this can be fixed. This is not the end of the world. I mean, quite to the contrary, we could lead the world in this area if we really got the will to do so.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our trucker hotline, our fuel line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello, everybody. And yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to tell you that due to the fuel increases in price, I'm losing about $600 a week right now.
Mm, right out of your pocket.
Right out of my pocket.
Now, how long can you keep going at that rate?
Well, there's two reasons for going. One is the family and, you know.
Sure.
Second is the fact, and this is the reason why we don't pull over, is the fact that we understand that we are very much needed and we don't want to create any more problems. We want to be part of the solution. And it's just like tightening the belt a little bit and, you know, going with the flow.
Okay. You know, I admire what you're doing, but Jerry and Craig, why should he have to make the sacrifice? Why don't the big oil companies drop their prices a little bit more?
Well, George, this is exactly the point. And the profits that are being made are going to be unconscionable unless the oil companies do get more supply, meaning building more refineries, because that's the blockage. With even more crude oil on the market right now today, it's impossible with the refineries operating at 96-97% capacity today to get more gasoline or heating oil into the market.
Yeah, but tomorrow Exxon will report record profits, probably up 60-80%. I mean, that's sinful.
Well, but let me, you know, I don't want to defend their actions, but we need to keep this in perspective. If we go back to 1998, when oil was $10 a barrel, the profits weren't anywhere near what they are today. And there were many years that the oil companies lost huge amounts of money building infrastructure. So while it's probably excessive right now, if you were to track the S&P and track the profits of an average oil company, they very, very seldom kept up with the return from the S&P. Now, recently, that hasn't been the case, and that's why Jerry and I are advocating that these oil companies do take these record profits and reinvest them for the benefit of the future of the nation. But let's remember that there are many years when oil was $10, $12 a barrel that these guys took it in the shorts. And now they're recuperating some of those losses.
But they still made money, didn't they? I mean, what's the salary of the president of BP?
Well, and of course, everybody would agree with you on that, George, that corporate America has excessive salaries, everybody from the dot-coms to the chip makers to the oil companies. And that should be changed, especially when you hear a man like this that has to dig in
his pocket. He's losing $600 a week.
$31,200 a year. He has to dig into his pocket to keep his job. That's not right.
No.
And I want to pick up, this gentleman also said that he felt an obligation, responsibility. He wanted to keep America moving.
He wants to be part of the solution.
Well, the oil companies have got to take that same thinking. The oil companies have to come forward and be part of the solution. Having record profits, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, is not going to sit with the American people when people like this gentleman driving his truck are having to make sacrifices to keep America going.
Are we taxing people too much, too, with a gallon of gasoline, and are we using that tax dollar effectively?
Absolutely, we're taxing too much. We do not have an energy policy in the United States. We have got a hodgepodge of systems and structures that don't really make any sense. All the refineries in the Gulf, when a hurricane comes through, destroying the capacity and putting refineries offline. We do not have any idea how much oil we could find in the United States if we went offshore.
Sure.
We went into Alaska. If we encourage, as we say in the book, with seven steps of solutions, incentive programs, taxes aimed at getting refineries online and drilling deeper. We do not need to burden the American people any further.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, welcome.
My name is Michelle, and I'm a truck driver also, me and my husband, and we're down in southern Texas, and I had some comments I want to make, but my question was, I haven't heard anybody talk about hot fuel, and I'm not talking about stolen fuel. I'm talking about temperature of the fuel. It's supposed to come to the stations at 70 degrees, and a lot of times it doesn't. And we've gotten fuel and not got the mileage that we're supposed to get, and come to find out the temperature of the fuel was too hot, so you don't get the BTUs don't match up. So instead of getting like 6 miles, you'll get 3 miles.
Is that done on purpose, Michelle?
Yes, it is. And the stations know it. They've got temperatures in the pumps themselves, and when the tanker brings it in and puts, you know, fills it up, it logs. They've got a system, you know, computer system, so it logs.
Okay,
everything.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and they're not only doing it on diesel, they're doing it on, you know, regular gasoline also. So when people aren't getting, you know, their fuel mileage that they're supposed to, it's because they've gotten hot fuel now. The stations are making a lot more money off of that fuel by, you know.
Well, how do they warm it up?
They don't leave it and let it cool and bring it straight out from the, I guess, the refinery or the gas plant. They bring it straight out, and the temperature's too hot because they're.
I've never heard this.
Have you? Either one of you? I haven't either. I know maybe Jerry has, but I don't understand the profit motive, because they heat the oil to crack it into the distillates.
It lowers your miles per gallon.
Which means
you end up using more fuel.
Well, the only thing I can figure is that if they had to keep it at 70 degrees, they would have to refrigerate the tankers going through the desert and
probably,
stuff, and maybe that
probably.
Would cost extra money. And they're saving that money in transportation, but
they say they bring 10,000 gallons out, you know, to the station.
All right.
Okay, they're telling you, and they're supposed to be repaying the taxes on 10,000 gallons. Well, in reality, they're charging people and gaining the taxes on 13,000 or 14,000 gallons. You see, but they're only shipping out 10,000 gallons.
Well, now that's something totally different, I guess.
I think that's fraud.
That's fraud.
And I think if that's reported to your state authorities, and the Bureau of Weights and Measurement can come out and calibrate those pumps. And
Yes, they do that, but they've already sold all of the fuel. So the consumers that's gotten the fuel and thought that they paid for that much gallons of fuel is not getting that many gallons of fuel.
So you're saying when you pump, you're expecting a certain amount of gallons, and you're not getting that.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, no, that's
fraud. And if you do a search on Google for hot fuel, it'll explain everything a lot better than,
I haven't
than
heard
what
that.
I can.
Jerry?
We'll look into
it.
I think it's a very good question and a very good point, and I think it's something we will look into.
Coming directly from a truck driver, who knows?
It's a very, very good point.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, this is Edward. I'm calling from Hinckley, California.
Hello, Edward.
Near Barstow. I'm not real sympathetic with the oil companies and the gasoline purveyors, because the prices right now in this country are obscene. This is the issue. In other words, all of these other solutions, boycotts and everything else, can work. But the first thing that needs to happen is the attention of the government and the attention of the oil companies needs to be gotten. And the most interesting question that has not been asked is, why in the world has this not been made an issue of national security? Think of the trillions of dollars that are now going to the Chinese government and that are now enriching the oil companies that are not going into our economy. And not a single politician, not a single leader has said to the American people, we empower you. We empower you. We lead. We're going to help. No help has come. No help has come. And these people aren't asking the question, why is this not a national security issue? Can you imagine?
And you're right. It could be huge right now.
I mean, think of all the money that has been taken away from health care, from all the chain stores, from all the businesses in each individual city, from truckers who couldn't go to barbecues. Think of all this. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of truckers out there listening to us in the middle of the night right now. You're empowered. Can you imagine FDR, you know, and this thing that happened with 9/11, we were all told to go shopping. Don't worry. You're not empowered. Don't worry about anything. We'll take care of you. Go shopping. Just go on about your business. This is what we've been told. We've been disempowered and disemboweled when we are the presidents of ourselves. We are presidents of what we do, and it's time for us to go. We dictate now to the oil companies and the government what we want. We want lower oil prices, and then we can go on to these other solutions. We want to be able to take care of our families, buy food, and do the things we're normally able to do that we can't because we're spending money. You know, the 30%, fully 30% of the oil that is produced in this country and that is imported in this country is going to China. It's been displaced from that input, and it's being sent to China because of their so-called demand for it, because of their boom. That's what's, and that has caused a false demand. There's not more use so much as there is less available to produce in this country. It's going overseas.
Why is it, Jerry, and thanks for your comments, and he's right.
Yes, he's got an excellent point, and we've talked about this extensively in the book, to say there's a transfer of wealth going on from the United States when 60% of our oil is imported, when we're dependent on foreign countries. And it's even funding terrorism when countries like Iran benefit from the rise in world oil prices. We have
even Saudi Arabia, that's supposed to be our friends, where most of the hijackers came from.
And Wahhabism is one of the most virulent strains of radical Islam that Saudi Arabia sponsors.
Look, if oil wasn't as big as it was, the Bin Laden family wouldn't have been able to get all that money in their construction, and Osama bin Laden wouldn't have gotten all his money from his family to do what he did.
You know, we talk about it in the chapter, the diminishing petrodollar, and how many billions upon billions of dollars are being transferred from this country into foreign countries, and the potential threats that that will pose in the future. We know that the Saudis held a telethon to raise $200 million to help support terrorism, yeah. Suicide bombing families, yeah. And Palestinians, and it's crazy that we're stripping that wealth out of America and transferring it into the hands of foreigners that may not have our best interest in the future in their minds.
And we've also undermined our currency in many ways by completely disassociating from the gold standard. We talk at length about how the Islamic countries are going back to the gold dinar and are trying to get oil traded in the gold dinar, which again is a national security threat to the United States that most Americans aren't even aware of.
True.
And we're arguing that we should at least have a foreign trade currency that is backed by the dollar. We should look at establishing one and take it very seriously, because the free-floating dollars we're having right now is an invitation to have a form of inflation going on that most Americans aren't even aware is happening.
Was it true that Saddam Hussein was going to switch from American dollars to euros, and that could be one of the reasons why he was ousted?
I believe that's part of it, and I also believe that, and I think this is documentable, and Jerry and I talk about it in the book, that Osama bin Laden's attack on the World Trade Center was clearly aimed at the bullseye of the heart of American finance. I mean, Wall Street evaporated, George. Mm-hmm. It was non-existent for 5 days.
Right.
You couldn't buy or sell a stock. We lost 1 million jobs right after 9/11. I mean, our travel industry went downhill. And so Osama bin Laden, in his writings to the American people in his letters of November 2004, said he is coming after us financially because we have stripped the wealth out of the Middle East in the form of oil and traded for our worthless U.S. dollars. And I don't think that attack's going to stop anytime soon.
Craig, you're chairman of board of an investment company, a big one, Swiss American Trading Corporation. How come they never released after 9/11? How come they never released who made money in those short sales of stock?
You know, I don't know. That's, you know, there's a lot of questions that I think the SEC, considering all the scandals that they were uncovering with the Delphi and Enron and all these mm-hmm. others, they seem to neglect to look at all the trading that went on September 10th, 11th, and 12th. And I don't have any hard evidence I can bring to the table to you tonight, George, but I think there was a tremendous amount of suspicious activity that went on during that whole time period, and it should be investigated.
Sure. And maybe it has. Maybe they already know who did it.
And George, you know the key element of the discussion of terrorism is terrorists are highly intelligent, and they recognize that they're fighting an economic war against the United States.
They're so smart, Jerry, they use dumb young kids to blow themselves up so they can do what they need to do. That's how smart they are.
That's right. And the increase in the price of oil and the weakening of the American economy with the transfer of the money going into the Persian Gulf states is a plan that Americans ought to be aware of. It's at our national security, because this is a weakening of the United States that we could reverse if we went to a policy of the United States being more oil independent. That's why in Black Gold Stranglehold we discuss terrorism at such length and say that there's an economic plan afoot here to weaken the United States by increasing unreasonably the price of oil.
You know what confuses me, too? We're coming up to a break, and then we've got the rest of the calls. In the United Arab Emirates, in Dubai, they are spending billions of dollars just to create islands, false islands in the sea, to allow rich people to go and have some fun. This is a Middle Eastern area. Aren't they concerned about terrorists trying to change that? No, nothing's ever going to happen there.
Yeah, and Dubai just opened up their own gold exchange, which we find interesting. It falls along these lines of these foreign countries, these Arab countries, yeah, moving back to a hard currency.
It's amazing. We'll be back with final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. The rest of your phone calls, I want to thank also Jerry Corsi and Craig Smith for staying an extra hour. We started an hour early with them. Did a little flip-flop. Let's also talk, before we go to the phone calls, very quickly, the seven-step solution that you believe will end American dependence on foreign oil. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, in the seven steps, we tried to make them as simple as possible so people could get their arms around them and actually get involved with the steps. First, we believe in promoting scientific research to investigate the alternative theories that are out there right now, George. We believe once scientists actually make a concerted effort to look at the theories that are out there, they're going to find a lot of opportunities that maybe they never thought about before. We believe in expediting offshore leases and also encouraging oil exploration in Alaska, mm-hmm, like in the Anwar, where we know that the U.S. Geological Survey has shown 10.3 billion barrels of recoverable reserves. There may be 10 times that. We don't know. But that's a million,
that's
a million five a day,
yeah,
that will take pressure off having to go to foreign entities. We want to provide, and I know some people are going to go, what? But we want to provide some tax credits for deep drilling oil exploration.
What?
That's what I figured everybody say. But we're talking about deep drilling oil exploration. It costs,
why give them credits? They got enough money.
Well, but here's the point. It costs billions of dollars to do it, and there is going to be some risk. Now, if they're making money, then they should pay taxes. And,
but
if they hit some areas that maybe they wouldn't take chances otherwise if there weren't any, you know.
So you're saying that you get an incentive for the risk.
Exactly. And look, I think the marketplace is going to make oil companies compliant, for lack of a better term, George. I don't think the oil companies are going to turn their back on the public and say, you know, the heck with you, we're going to make our money. I think
they've done it so far.
I think they're listening now, though. I think now that you've got Denny Hassert talking about it and programs like yours talking about it, and I hear the anger and the frustration in the callers' voices. Those are potential customers. You can only upset your customers and squeeze them so long before they rebel. And
if we do three major things in this country, I'm telling you, Americans, most Americans, would be so ecstatic. They'd be jumping for joy. Their lives would change overnight. One would be, and they're talking about this now, revamping entirely the income tax code. Just
right.
Maybe even doing away with it, going to some kind of nominal use tax, where people can have the bulk of their money and spend it the way they want to.
Sure.
I mean, that would be dramatic for them. Some Republican senators out of South Carolina are even recommending not even having to file anything. I mean, that would be dramatic. Change this system where the price of fuel is reasonable. I don't think anybody, you know, we talk about alternative free energy. I don't think anybody is going to argue about paying something
for fuel, as long as it's fair, so they're not strapped every month. And then if we can truly do something about terrorism, and part of that will go away if we don't have to rely on some of these governments and countries that are supporting the terrorism, we kind of just get out of there. Now, we will always need a strong defense, because honestly nowadays, I don't trust any of these other countries anymore. You know, I don't know what they're up to. And I think we need to take a very aggressive posture to leaders who harbor terrorists.
I agree. And I think if there was one major area that Jerry and I saw that is a stranglehold that concerns both Jerry and I the most, is a stranglehold that countries have that clearly and openly support terrorism around the world, and we're fueling their ability to keep that terrorism going.
Yes.
That is a national security threat, George, that every single American should be concerned
about. And you don't need an army to do this.
That's true.
And that is another approach.
And, George, we tried to write this so that it is easy to read, so that it's not require, you know, we took the numbers out, we made it simple, we explained the science.
It's not scientific, but it's knowledgeable science.
Because we wanted to empower the people who read this in order to have the tools they need to communicate to the oil companies and to Congress and the president the need to get a reasonable oil policy for America, a reasonable energy policy that will put in the hands of people reasonable prices for gasoline, oil, heating fuel, etc., so that we can have an economy that continues to grow and be strong.
You're both proponents of nuclear power. I'm petrified ever since Chernobyl. How do we get around that?
Nuclear power can be made to be safe. Every form of energy, anything we do, is going to have a risk to it. But there's something like 430 nuclear power plants operating worldwide today, and we've had one or two accidents in it. Now, the accidents can be dramatic, but we've had a nuclear energy system around the world now for 40 years or longer that has been commercialized and can be run effectively.
Can we get by, if we have a different way of getting oil, can we get by without all these nuclear power plants?
Yes, we can, and I still think that there's some reasons to have nuclear power advanced. Again, the idea that it's a multiple solution. It's kind of like attacking cancer. It's not just one solution, but there's multiple solutions that have to be implemented in a mix. Also, remember, Exxon Valdez, Chernobyl, these things stand out as dramatic in our minds. We don't think of the hundreds and hundreds of operations and plants that go on without problems and can be managed effectively and are managed effectively today, every day.
You know, just south of here, George, you have San Onofre. It's been operating very safely for well over 35 years
right
now. I live 50 miles from the Palo Verde nuclear plant outside of Phoenix, Arizona. We don't even think twice about it because it's got the technology has advanced so far over the last 40 years that we can really build things safe. As Jerry said, everything has a risk. I mean, getting in your car driving home tonight has a risk. But I think we can mitigate that risk substantially with the new technologies that are out there and provide good, clean, affordable energy as we move the technology along and the prices come down.
Let's go back to the phones now. Let's pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Ron.
Hey, Ron. And good to have you with us.
I guess my question is directed at your guest.
Okay.
When I was growing up, I understood that the gas, the natural gas and the oil that came from our state had to be sold in another state. Is that still true, or is it?
I'm not aware of any restriction of that nature.
Yeah, years ago, because you had refineries, well over 300 plus, that were directly aligned to areas where the oil was being pulled out of the ground, sometimes you had these exchanges going on beyond the states. But once the refineries were consolidated and the infrastructure was pulled to certain areas like the Gulf, Louisiana, Mississippi, I haven't heard of any of that happening over the last, you know, several years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Trucker Hotline, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello. He's not with us anymore.
Quiet truck.
He ran out of fuel. You never know. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, evening, George. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
My name is Charles. I'm calling from Virginia. This is perfect timing because yesterday on another talk show, the host took this article that he read to us at face value, and I first heard the article and I said, smokescreen. Yesterday in the Financial Times, they wrote an article stating that the reason why the price of oil per gallon, I mean the price of the oil in the drum was so high, is because the platform workers were on drugs. Like drugs was just invented this past year. you need to read the article. It was in yesterday's Financial Times, and I heard this, and I said, "What? Well, that's ridiculous." You know, I love there the comments that you have.
All right, I think you'll both agree that's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Blaming on the workers does not sound like a good solution.
One thing Voltaire once said about common sense. One thing about common sense is not very common.
No, not at all. Next up, west of the Rockies, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, this is Gary in Utah.
Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
I'm just got a question about you guys are talking about alternate fuel sources. What about making diesel fuel out of coal? Because I'm from the area of Utah where we produce coal, and I was just curious. I've heard about this for the past 3 or 4 years.
Well, that can be done. As a matter of fact, in Illinois, I have a buddy of mine who was sitting at the airport. An old gentleman was sitting next to him and is building a coal plant to have gasoline.
Yeah, liquefied coal is becoming very, very advanced.
And he said $25 a barrel.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I think that now that they've been able to clean up the coal and liquefy it, I think, once again, because the price has gone so high, George, it's going to open up a whole new arena of technologies that back when oil was $20 a barrel, that just weren't cost effective.
Right.
Now that it's at $60 a barrel, it becomes way more cost effective. And I believe, as I said before, once the technology advances, the prices will come down as a natural course of the market.
And again, the creativity, the ability to innovate are one of the reasons that all these doom and gloom, the Malthusian thinkers, you know, the population is going to grow so fast, we're going to be out of food. Well, the Earth has been able to support, you know, billions of people and can support many more. We can grow, we can have effective economies. The stranglehold starts with the idea limitations we impose on ourselves, like that oil is fossil fuel. If we get rid of these ideas and begin looking effectively with a positive view to getting more energy into the market of a variety of kinds, we can bring the price down and we can solve the problems.
Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, this is Gary calling from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Hi, Gary, it's all yours.
Okay, are you familiar with the newer, anything from 96 on up, OBD2, vehicles where everything is hooked up and run by a computer, and if the vehicle fails inspection for any deviation from original manufacturer specification, okay, you cannot change what's under the hood of that vehicle. And in fact, anything with an oxygen sensor on it, you can't change.
True. Well, we've got that in Missouri, too, where they have emissions
it's
and you got to go through
it's
that.
It's all over, but it's leading up to my point here. All vehicles are set up to 14.7:1 air fuel ratio. Hey, that's right up there with global warming and fossil fuels. I have proven the gasoline can be turned into propane, and it can get over 100 miles per gallon on any vehicle without the computer.
I want your data.
Okay. It's so simple. What is the difference, if you look at it under a microscope, between propane and gasoline? It's all the same thing. It's the way the fuel is distributed. Now, the older systems, I went to the U.S. Patent Office when I first started researching this, and the first one I saw was bought out by Standard Oil of New Jersey in 1914. And this was a heater coil that went underneath the carburetor on a Model T Ford, and it could take petroleum straight out of the ground, and the car would get like 50 miles per gallon.
Well, and they have been known to buy off these patents
they've been relegated to the status of little green men from Mars.
True.
Things that go bump in the night, and I've proven it. I can take gasoline, turn it to a clear dry vapor, and put a blower on this little gadget, and it feels just like air coming out of the hose, and light it on fire, and the flame starts out blue. Then it turns yellow, then orange, then with a little black tip of carbon.
Jerry, how does someone like him get investment money to do what he says he can do?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to see more innovations coming on, and these kinds of ideas, sir, you should pursue it. Get yourself in the process of getting a patent. Get yourself in the process of finding others who agree and can fund whatever you need to get
somebody
the next step. Someone will do it. But again, as Craig said a minute ago, with oil at increasing prices, alternatives are going to be looked at, and yours may very well merit both being looked at an investment. So continue.
Jerry, I want to take a couple minutes and we'll wrap up with a caller or two very quickly. President of Iran today, who's merely a figurehead for the mullahs. He was a terrorist in his own right, part of, I think, the embassy takeover back in the 70s, says that Israel should be wiped off the face of the map. Very dangerous for a guy like that to say that in light of the fact that we believe Iran is building its nuclear capability. What do you think the Israelis, I want you to make a prediction, what do you think the Israelis will do, because they take a very tough approach with people who make these kinds of threats, what are they going to do?
Israel is in the process right now, George, and it's a great question. Israel is contemplating that the world is going to abandon Israel, that the president of the United States is already politically weakened by Iraq and internal problems, the nomination of Harriet Myers. Israel is moving towards thinking it's going to have to solve the problem itself and launch a military strike against Iran. That's what's in the works. That's what's going to happen. Israel will set a date in 2006 beyond which they won't tolerate any more continued worthless negotiations. It won't go to the United Nations. The United Nations Security Council will be worthless. Russia's already indicated that they will not take seriously stopping Iran and its nuclear weapons
will
program.
Russia get involved to stop Israel?
Yes. They'll try to block the whole issue from coming to the United Nations, and they will side with Syria and with Iran.
Are we on the brink of a third world war
yes,
if all this happens?
We're on the brink of a war that could break into a third world war, because when Israel strikes Iran, they'll strike anywhere from 10 to 20 sites simultaneously. They'll do it with airplanes. They may use
conventional,
possibly some nuclear. The nuclear will be standing ready. We'll have to cooperate. We have troops in the area. But Israel will set a date, and I don't know what the date will be, but they'll set a date in 06 beyond which they will not go, and they'll have a strike because they'll feel abandoned. They can't tolerate to wake up one morning and have an atomic 9/11 over Tel Aviv.
Well, especially when the guy's saying he'll do it.
Well, that's exactly right, George. That statement today was so bold. They're feeling that they can get away with anything, and no one's going to stop them.
Yeah.
They're convinced that George Bush is completely weakened, that George Bush is powerless.
Is he?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
And has no resolve and no direction. This should have been addressed in March. It's when I thought it would have been addressed in March of this year. That's what the administration said. Vice President Cheney was set on that path. The president went over to Europe, sent Condoleezza Rice to Europe, comes back and says we're going to work with the European to negotiate this. So that's worthless. That's going to be more drawn-out negotiations with sociopaths and psychopaths. When Ahmadinejad says that he's going to destroy Israel, wipe it off the face of the earth, he means it. It should be taken deadly seriously. They're pursuing the development of nuclear weapons in a clandestine fashion, and the Iranians will be happy to push the world to the brink of thermonuclear war.
And what does China do with all this?
China's going to stand on the sidelines and hope the war doesn't involve them. China's going to play its own advantage. There's a billion Chinese. It's one of the things Ahmadinejad is also on the record, as well as Khomeini, saying there's a billion Islam believers. They can take 200 million losses.
Mm-hmm.
The mullahs think that they can get out of the country. They think that they can survive. They think they'll know when it's going
to
happen.
And they know where to go. They already have their escape route, don't they?
They've made themselves wealthy. They have vacation homes. They've got businesses
in
Europe.
How many people are we talking about running Iran right now? 50 guys. Probably.
And probably there's one guy.
With a few billion in the bank.
The Ayatollah runs it together with the Supreme Council. There's a handful. There's maybe a dozen at most. Ahmadinejad, the president, is a mouthpiece, though he's a very dangerous one. And that he was made president indicates the country's moving in a radical direction.
Well, he took the popular vote. Right,
the popular fixed vote, he was the pick choice, and he was the guy they wanted to be in there. And today's statements had a degree of boldness that the world should take seriously, because when Hitler says he's going to exterminate the Jews, he meant it. And when Ahmadinejad says he wants to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, he means it.
Well, this book, of course, Black Gold Stranglehold. Jerry Corsi,
Craig Smith, thank you both for spending the time on the program.
Great being with you.
George, an honor to be here. Thank you.
For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norris. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.